order. And this is, we're actually opening up an informational meeting. It's a little hot in here. We've asked folks to turn down the heat, but I apologize. It wasn't just me. So we have a lot of information to share this morning. We had, as you know, a pretty busy legislative session in 2007, so one of the things that we wanted to do today were provide updates for the committee members on some of the key pieces of legislation that passed on energy last session. We also will hear a brief update on the Water Supply Conservation Initiative from the Oregon Water Resources Department. We'll have another panel. We heard last time on climate change. We have another panel on climate change, and then we're going to have a work session on some possible legislative concepts. But first, I would like to officially welcome Representative Garrard, who is a new member of the committee.
Thank you.
And really pleased to have you here. And
thank you.
Representative Garrard and I served on the Natural Resources Subcommittee on Ways and Means, and we've worked together for 7 years. Since you've been serving since when? You were here before, in 99?
I got here one term before you did.
Well, really pleased that you said yes, and we're happy to have you here. And also, I think Representative Reed, who has come to all of the field trips and really pleased about that, but we should officially make sure folks know that he's a new member, replaced Representative Greg McPherson on the committee, and really pleased to have you as well.
Madam Chair, it just won't serve well to have both of us stand up at the same time.
You could do that, but you'll have a crick in your neck. We have, yes, I think we have the tallest members of the legislature and the shortest members of the legislature right here, and we've got a little bit in between, so it's sort of interesting how that happened in my committee. So, and with that, I will ask, we are first going to hear updates, as you see on your agenda, on implementation of 2007 energy legislation. I don't know, Beth, do you want to mention a few words on that?
Okay.
And we're really pleased to have Beth Petrino as our committee staff back with us. We're going to hear updates on the Betsy, the Retsy, basically all of these energy bills that passed last session. And then last but not least, we'll have an update on biofuels because there's some rulemaking that's going on right now and some advisory committees that are meeting. So first we're going to hear, I guess, the State Department of Energy is going to come up and give us an update on all that. Mr. Greening, welcome back. Hope you had a nice little break.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm Mike Rainey. I'm director of the Department of Energy, and with me is Bill Nesmith, who's the assistant director in charge of our Energy Conservation Division, which most of these bills involve the programs in his area. And the list you have, we could just walk right down that list because I think that is the major focus of our rulemaking. I did provide to the committee members a summary of all the energy bills that you passed last session. There were 25 bills in all. It was a quite comprehensive package of bills for energy efficiency and renewable energy. But I think the ones you have listed here are the key ones, and certainly the key ones in terms of our rulemaking efforts. And I want to briefly talk about where each of those are, and then we'd be happy to answer questions or go into more detail on those. First, on all of these, our goal was to have rules in place by the end of this year. We are on track to do that, with the exception of one issue on one bill, which I'll mention. With regard to the Business Energy Tax Credit, the BETC, which was part of House Bill 3201 as it was finally passed, there were some significant changes in the program to encourage greater use of and development of renewable energy. The key changes were the increase of the tax credit from limit from $10 million to $20 million per project, an increase in the percentage of the credit from 35% of the eligible cost to 50%, an increase in eligibility for small hydro from 1 megawatt in size to 10 megawatts. There were also provisions regarding allowing home builders who install solar measures in homes to receive the tax credit, as well as the homeowners. There was incentives for manufacturing facilities that produce components for renewable energy, such as solar and wind, and changes to some technical changes as well. We are through virtually all of the issues on the rulemaking on that. We've held a number of hearings and workshops. Our intent is to adopt final rules on the Betsy next week, with the exception of one issue. And the one issue is the manufacturing component facilities. We've set that issue aside for it'll probably take an additional month to wrap that up. We're going to have a revised rule out and additional opportunity for comment and at least one hearing on that next month or in early January. That issue involves some complex issues because of the size of some of these facilities. We've had a couple of them recently locate in Oregon, attracted by the tax credit. So the tax credit is just doing the work that was intended by the changes you made. One, Solaix is in North Portland. Solar World is in Beaverton Hillsboro area. And we're working with developers there on definitions of what is more than one project, because these facilities are sufficiently complex that the same site can present more than one project, and we need to define that the rules and the criteria for that a little more effectively. But that's the one issue that's outstanding. A couple of the points that we have addressed in the rules specifically is we had a cost-effective payback criteria for solar energy that I know was a concern to the solar industry. We've revisited that, and we've revised that incentive so that the incentive is increased, and recognizing that while there's cost-effective requirements in terms of consumer protection, that this is also intended as an incentive for renewable energy. And that particular payback requirement was having more of an effect on solar energy, adverse effect than on, we didn't have a similar requirement on the other renewable energy types. So the criteria change, it's a technical change, but it puts that incentive level more in line with the other renewable energy incentives. And I think it's responsive to the solar industry's needs. Another provision in the bill, or in our rulemaking rather, deals with sustainability in commercial buildings. And that's actually been a feature that's been in our rulemaking or in our statute for some years, since either 1999 or 2001. But there was some discussion last session on a couple of bills of the LEED certification versus Green Globes. And our current rules provide only for LEED because LEED was the only certification system in place when the statute went into force that allowed us to give the tax credit for sustainability. We have been received comments from the Green Building Industry Council that supports Green Globes as an alternative, and we've been working with them. There are some issues with some aspects of the Green Globe certification, but we think with verification that we can use at least one aspect of the Green Globes, and our rules will reflect that there can be an alternative path for sustainability besides LEED as well. So again, we're on target to finish to have these rules in place out on the street final within the next week or so, and they'll be effective. They'd be effective before the first of the year. Be effective immediately.
Yeah.
So they'd be effective sometime next week. On the residential tax credit, the RETSI, which was also well, let me stop and ask if there's any questions before I move
any
on.
Any questions specifically on the business energy tax credit? Yes, we have from my vice chair.
And thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, Mike, I again want to thank you for the outstanding work that you and your department do on this stuff. I had another call this week from actually the U.S. Forest Service interested in some of these tax credits for the biomass stuff, and your office was very helpful in getting me some information to get back to them, so I appreciate that a great deal.
Thank you.
The pass-through rate on Betsy, how's that been resolved?
And the pass-through rate, what that is, that's for people who don't have tax liability, either businesses that are new or small or nonprofits and schools and local governments that can use the tax credit too. You transfer the tax credit, and the business tax credit is normally taken over 5 years. And with the previously, when the rate was a 35% tax credit over 5 years, the pass-through rate, what we call the pass-through rate, was 25.5%. And what that means is a business that has a tax liability, a bank, for example, would make a payment to the owner of the facility for 25.5% of the eligible cost, then they would take the 35% tax credit over 5 years, that bank. With the 50%, we've calculated the pass-through rate, and this is something we set in rule each year, at 33.5% was our final rate. And what we're balancing is a number of factors, including the economic present value of what is worth, given the dollar amount is worth now versus 5 years from now, and also enough of an incentive so that there will be companies willing to make the payment now to receive the tax credit. So if it's too high an amount, they won't be held even, be willing to make the investment. If it's too low, it's not enough of an incentive for the developers of the renewable energy project. But the 33.5%, I think, ended up with a pretty good deal of consensus and support from all the parties involved. So that is our final number.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions on the Betsy Representative?
And we'll look at that again next year. Okay, we'll look at that each year.
Representative Kim.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Mike, could you say just a little bit more about the change to the payback period? Is that the period of time over which the renewable energy device has to show that it is cost effective versus the standard, and did that payback period then increase? Is that the technical change that you made?
Mr. Chairman, let me ask Bill to address that.
Can you state your name also?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Bill Nesmith, Oregon Department of Energy. We had a limitation in the residential program that said you would get a credit up to $1,500 and not to exceed 60 cents per kilowatt hour, per kilowatt for the system. The 60-cent number had not been changed for many, many years, and we were hearing from the solar industry, as Mike pointed out, that the number was too low, and the price of the resource was more expensive than that now. So after some extensive conversation with the industry, we raised that cap to $2, multiplied by the first-year energy yield in kilowatt hours. That's the current. And that kind of relieved some of the pressure that we were feeling in the program.
So it still provides, an incentive based on the efficiency of the system, but we think it's a more effective incentive level.
Thanks.
Okay. I actually have one request. Any other questions? I understand we are not the revenue committee. However, as you know, the majority of the vetting of this bill actually came through this committee. I think what would be helpful for the committee members is if you can provide a list of the companies, folks that are receiving the Betsy, and you know what that amount is. And it would be interesting, obviously, to compare with the next cycle with the increase to 50%. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, what did that do? Did that mean we had a whole different array of types of folks that were coming and applying for the Betsy? I don't know if you have that information now. It's a little early, but I think that type of summary would be really good.
We'd be glad to put that together for you, Madam Chair. And we are seeing significant increases in renewable energy projects already as a result, and it was, you know, people seeing as the bill was going forward with the effective date of 1/1/07, which I think was very important, that they could do their planning for projects, and we're seeing those, and we've also seen three large solar manufacturing facilities located in Oregon, and potentially there's another two or three that could, so that it's clearly having an impact.
Great. Yeah, if you can provide that information to Beth, and then she can send that out to the committee. The other is, you didn't talk about the raise in the cap for projects, so that's mm-hmm. another factor, and you maybe just want to remind the committee about that.
Yeah. Yes, the project cap increased from $10 to $20 million and for each project or facility, and that clearly benefits renewable energy projects. Most conservation projects aren't that large, although some cogeneration facilities potentially are. But clearly this will benefit facilities like Pacific Ethanol Biofuels facility that you visited last month in Boardman, wind farms, solar manufacturing facilities. It will definitely help renewable energy generally, biomass facilities, forest products, energy facilities. So, and we've definitely had interest from companies in all those areas, and I think we'll see more of those projects.
Okay, thank you. Okay, if there's no more questions on the Betsy and Retsy, why don't we just keep going through onto the 1.5% solar requirement.
Okay. Maybe on the Retsy one, just mention briefly, and that was a simpler bill, but
oh,
it clarified.
Sorry, we didn't talk about Retsy.
That was also part of 3201 as it passed. It increased the incentive for wind and for fuel cells comparable to solar, increased it from $1,500 maximum to $6,000 for individuals over 4 years. More importantly, it also allowed multiple tax credits in 1 year, so that whether it's solar systems, you could have a solar hot water system, you could have a solar PV system on your home, you could have multiple energy-efficient appliances in your home, which use the same tax credit. And that rulemaking was pretty simple, and that's done. That those rules will take effect next week as well. And we didn't have any significant issues on that.
I'm sure.
Question from Representative Early.
So those credits are also effective in this 2007?
Yes. The effective date for those was also 1107, and that's also consistent, actually, with the tax credits in the biofuels bill, 2210. Those. And I think that was important, again, to allow individuals to do planning and make financial arrangements so that these projects could come online as soon as possible.
Okay.
The next two bills, House Bill 2620, that was one that Representative Holvey introduced, and it requires that for new public buildings, that 1.5% of the cost of the building be devoted to cost-effective solar investments in the building. We think it's a good approach. It's we think it will result in significant use of solar in cost-effective applications. It can include everything from hot water heating, space heating, electric generation, PV systems. The rules basically were defining what the parameters are and what the criteria are for an agency. There is a provision in the bill that says if a building is use of solar energy would be inappropriate for that building, and there are some situations where that would be, then the state agency doesn't have to, or the local agency, whichever one's developing the project, doesn't have to use solar in that case, or at least solar up to 1.5%. The decision is that state agency's, but there is a review process that we go through in terms of assuring that reasonable criteria are met. And we will also be reporting the progress of implementation of that bill in a annually in a report that we'll put together, and that will be publicly available.
I have a quick question on that, Mike. How are you notifying, since it's not just state agencies, it's local, counties, cities, how are you notifying? I mean, through your typical rulemaking process, or will you do some type of outreach to local officials about this?
Bill, do you want to do that?
Madam Chair, We have a fairly extensive informal meeting process. There's an official formal process as well, but we reach out to people in the marketplace that are affected by this. We also work with the associations, League of Oregon City Association, Oregon Counties. I mean, we do extensive outreach to try to make this as responsive as we can to what the legislature asks for and also the people in the marketplace. And we've had a number of meetings to get input and come up with the proposal that we have on the table now.
We also, Madam Chair, we have, in addition to those meetings, we have a hearing scheduled for next week on the 4th, and final comment period ends the next day on the 5th. So, and these rules in various forms have been out for quite a while, so we expect that we'll be able to wrap that up and have the rules in place again by the end of December.
I think Representative Beyer has a question on this issue.
Yes, thank you. I happen to, you know, I voted for this bill and starting to wonder if this was a good choice because it's impacting my district, school district. At this point, we passed a bond last November to build some new schools without knowing that this was coming. It looks like about it could possibly be about a $400,000 addition to the cost of the schools they're building. And so they have some concerns, and I have talked to a few people about it, and I hope that you are willing to continue working with school districts. Those that have already, you know, bidded out their projects before the first of the year aren't going to be impacted by this, but the schools that haven't are going to be impacted. And one of the questions is your definition of state funds on subsection 4 in the bill, which says does not apply to public improvements in which no state funds are directly or indirectly used. So the question is this in the construction or is this in the operation and maintenance of the buildings?
Okay. I'm going to call Betty Merrill up. Betty is a person who works closely with the school districts on this. And, again, the overlay is that the investments have to be cost-effective, and that includes to the school district in your case.
Thank you, Betty.
Representative Dean, Representative Beyer.
Can you state your name?
Betty Merrill, Oregon Department of Energy. What we tried to do, the bill was pretty fuzzy as to an effective date, and in trying to come up with what's an effective date, what we have in our current rules that are posted for the public hearing next week is the effective date is the date of a permit. So if you have your permit today, the bill doesn't apply. As of January 1st, it won't apply. We have had 8 sets of workshops involving school districts, ESDs, local governments, cities, state agencies, universities, community colleges. We try to be, you know, out there trying to collect input so that we could do it reasonably in terms of what buildings are eligible, which buildings are ineligible. So we've tried to get that to get there. The hearing's on the 4th. I'm expecting some input. So.
The question I have, and, you know, we're having a hard time hearing, so you guys have to move the mics a little bit closer. They're pretty sensitive, but you speak into them, especially for folks behind you to hear. Question I have, and in regarding to Representative Beyer's question, you know, looking at a $400,000 impact, but does that include the cost savings over the life of the building? I mean, that's an upfront capital cost. I don't know if the districts are looking at this energy savings and that is when you're working with the, you know, entities that you're dealing with, are they factoring that in to the life cycle cost of their building?
What the issue that Representative Beyer is bringing up is something where money was, the district went out for a bond, obtained, you know, authorization for so much in funding, had a plan developed and is going forward through the bid process. Now they have a new requirement that they didn't originally intend to fund. What we have tried to do is allow for flexible and innovative funding so that if we wanted to encourage people to use, leverage their funding by being able to use potentially federal grants, federal tax credits, utility incentives, BETSI, and a third party, what are called power purchase agreements, so that the public entity doesn't actually own the system, but purchase the power and owns the system. It's like a lease purchase. Mm-hmm. So that would also be allowed. Do they consider cost effectiveness in terms of the reduction in their energy use or what they're going to get on the net metering? My experience with project managers is when they come to the end of their project, they have less money than they have project. And so they start doing value engineering. And that's where the strain is at this point.
Thank you.
I'll follow up. I think maybe I heard someone say construction over here, but I didn't really get an answer to construction, no state funds used in construction or operations. So I want to make sure I'm clear.
It's construction if it's state funds in the construction of the building. Okay. Then if 1.5%... The bill said 1.5% for all public buildings. If your building is inappropriate to add solar to, if it's a state-funded project, a state agency, university, okay, they would have to, if the building was inappropriate, it's under trees or whatever, they would take that 1.5% and do it on the next building. If it is a local government building and it's found to be inappropriate on this structure, they're not required to move that 1.5% forward if it is not state funded.
Okay. And one just comment, and another piece is the fact that in the valley, not so much on the central Oregon, where we don't have quite as much sun as they do over there, and a school operates from September to June and is not in operation during most of the optimum solar months that we have. And I know you can use solar in other months, but whether it's as effective, and they're not even operating during those months, is something that I think that we maybe aren't thinking about either.
Well, just a question about that. When net metering agreement, it wouldn't matter because they'd still be selling their power back. Is that correct, during the summer months?
Absolutely. When they're not weekends, right. Anytime they're not using it.
Right. So it would offset the cost of the energy cost for the school.
Right.
And, Madam Chair, Representative Beyer, the cost-effective requirement for the investment would take into account the school's overall energy bills, and that includes whether or not they're in session during the summer or using those buildings. So it is intended to that cost-effective criteria was an important consideration in being included in the final version of the bill that passed.
Okay, we're going to have to keep moving if we're going to get through all of these, so appreciate it. That answer your question?
Yep.
Okay, thank you. Good question.
Okay. I'm sure then the next one deals with appliance standards, and you actually passed two bills last session, Senate Bill 375 and House Bill 2565. As a follow-up to legislation you passed in the previous session, establishing efficiency standards for certain commercial appliances and other electrical equipment. Those standards were based on the California energy standards adopted in California and have been adopted by a number of other states. And the intent was to adopt identical standards so that manufacturers would have the choice of either federal standards where there are some for the states that adopt a more efficient standard, it's the same standard throughout. House Bill 2565 had made some technical corrections to legislation that you passed in the previous session. And Senate Bill 375 picked up additional equipment that was adopted by California. Again, in our rulemaking, we made it clear that the requirements are identical to California's. We have... I believe we finished the hearings on that, and we hope to have that final bill, or for those final rules, effective at the end of next month also. And all of our comments were really that we received were in the mode of do it the same as California, make sure everything we do is the same as California's, and we're trying to make sure that that happens.
Okay, any questions on those before we move on to the renewable portfolio standards? All right, thank you. I'm going to ask Lee Beyer if he'll come up and join the podium. I think
And Madam Chair, most of the rulemaking authority and activity is by the PUC on this bill. We just have a small portion, so I think I defer to lead off on this.
Welcome, Mr. Beyer.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. For the record, I'm Lee Beyer. I'm the chair of the Oregon Public Utility Commission, and I have brought with me Lisa Swartz, who is the lead analyst, know-all, do-all on renewable energy at the PUC. So if you've got any really hard questions, I'm going to give them to her. As you'll recall, 838 established the renewable portfolio standards applying to utilities in Oregon. Effectively, that bill, at least in the early years, applies mainly to three utilities, Portland General Electric, Pacific Power, and the Eugene and Water and Electric Board. And the PUC just has two of those, fortunately, that they probably collectively represent about 85-90% of the goal of achievement that you're trying to get in terms of this. So I'm going to focus on where we're at with that and then touch a little bit on the rulemaking at the end. And hopefully this won't take a whole lot of your time, so I'll try to be quick. You have a handout in front of you, and what I wanted to start out with is just to give you a real quick snapshot of where we're going on this. Actually, I should say where the utilities are going, since we're just sort of holding the whip and they're driving the train, if you will. The goal for the first goal, 2011, is 5%, and as you'll see on the chart, both utilities are projected to meet that goal fairly easily. They're both near 10% on that. The numbers, when you get out in the out years, the 2015 goal would be 15%, and essentially the numbers that I'm talking about here are projections based in their integrated resource plans that we have to date, and frankly, at least, well, actually, for both of them, the plans were before time, but we're just reviewing that now. So it may appear they're a little low, but they're on target. I will tell you that in the work that we've been doing with PGE, PGE expects to be at almost 18% of their portfolio by 2012. Pacific Core is moving up towards that number, too. They have a bigger number. Different issues I should point out when you're looking at this. We're talking about only that portion of the energy that's used in Oregon. PGE, that's easy. All of their service territories in Oregon. When we deal with Pacific Core, we have an allocation issue there. They're a six-state utility, and electricity doesn't know state line boundaries, so we have to allocate that, and the power comes from different places. That's more of an issue as we try to. I mean, one of the key questions to us is if they have, for example, Pacific is looking at 2,000 megawatts of renewables, what portion of that belongs in Oregon? And frankly, the actual use is going to flow over time, where it's at any time of year, time of day, that sort of thing. But we're doing more of an accounting measure on that, just to let you know. I thought you'd be interested in terms of the next map in your package, a color map. That's essentially the territory that Pacific Core serves, and it shows you where their six wind projects are. And they're moving ahead, and there are a number of them under construction, and as I said, we're looking at 2,000 megawatts over their territory there. I think it's rather exciting. The next one behind that speaks to Portland General Electric's projects. They have four basic projects that they're looking at there. The last one, Bigelow Canyon, has three phases in it, and they're partially through two of those. So there's a lot going on there. The next page, I just thought you'd be interested in knowing this is a map that shows most, although there's some omitted, of the wind projects that are in the Oregon, Washington, sort of the Columbia area. Shows you where they're at. And you see there's a lot out there. There's a lot going on with that. But wind's not the only renewable that we've been dealing with, and I just wanted to highlight some of the others. Most of our work on this, a lot of it's done with the Energy Trust of Oregon. Energy Trust is doing an 18 megawatt biomass project that they're working on. That's one of the ones. They're also working on an almost 16 megawatt plant with the Warm Springs Reservation over in that area. I know Representative Burley is well aware of that one. And PacifiCorps is doing a number of that, too. We're looking at things beyond just biomass. We're looking at dairies, digesters, landfills, that sort of thing. So trying to capture every little bit you can. Some of the difficulty of that is many of these projects, frankly, are very small. And when we're looking predominantly at the old, you know, sort of fixed station generator, you're looking at 200, 500, 600 megawatts, and these are coming in onesies and twosies kinds of things. So it gets a little tougher to do it this way, but I think we're making, the utilities are making great progress. I know Representative Dingfelder has a big interest in solar. I know she put one on her residence. We've done, and I believe she worked with the Energy Trust through that one. The Trust has done 1,000 of those units, and thanks to the legislation that you passed and the tax credits that Mike says, there's more interest in doing that. Geothermal is a tougher one. We do, PacifiCorps is expanding the geothermal plant. It's not in Oregon, but it's a facility that provides electricity for Oregonians. So we're moving ahead with that. And there's also been some hydro. You had a small window for additional small hydro. There have been a couple of projects there. The biggest one has been improvements to PG's Round Butte facility, and it was about 50 average megawatts that picked up there. There's also been some smaller ones that PacifiCorps and PG have been dealing with. The one thing that I did want to alert you to is we're making good progress, and I think we're going to hit all the goals over time that the legislature desired. But you should be aware that I think in the future you're going to hear from your constituents. The cost of power is going up, and it's going to go up substantially. And that's for a few reasons. A lot of the focus you may hear will be on renewables, and certainly renewables has gotten more expensive, but so has all other generation sources too, and load is growing, so that's going to be an issue. And some of the major drivers on that, on the renewable side, is there's a lot of demand for that, and some of the projects I was showing you earlier there, those wind farms, not all of that's going to be serving Oregonians. A lot of that is in competition to meet very aggressive goals in Washington State and California. So the market and the price for renewables is going up greatly. Part of that, because of that, you're also having, on the wind side, incredible increasing pressures on demand for the turbines themselves. So there's a competition that's driving the price up there. The other piece of that that's important to understand is that those units have a lot of construction costs, primarily steel. The price of steel on the global market is going up. That's affecting all generation coal plants, even in other parts of the country. We've heard of costs doubling inside of 12 months on those, so those are going up. And then, frankly, the last thing that's having a mega impact on that is the U.S. dollar versus European currencies and Asian currencies. A lot of these parts are manufactured out of state, so we're just having a lot of drivers that are pushing those costs up. And so I'm sure that I'm going to hear about this, and I'm sure you're going to hear about this, and I'm sure that I'll be responding to your constituent inquiries in the future on these issues. But just
we'll just send them all to you. We'll just send them all to you.
That's perfectly fine, Madam Chair. We will take care of those. But given that, you know, we're working on that and the costs are going up, the other side of the 838 was some increases in energy efficiency that you included in there, and I just wanted to set the stage for you on that one. Our primary energy efficiency efforts come about through the public purpose charge that was passed out of the 1149 and 1999 session. But when we looked at that, we noted that there's quite a bit of energy savings that's possible out there that we couldn't capture under that funding. You allowed utilities, and this is permissible legislation, you allowed them to come to the PUC with a plan to capture that additional opportunity. The chart that's in your packet shows the megawatt gap, if you will, that's in there of cost effective. And in this case, we're looking primarily opportunities that on a levelized basis would cost less than 2 cents a kilowatt hour, compared to if you're looking at new generation, we're looking at the 5 to 8 cents a kilowatt hour now. So substantial monetary benefit to customers if we can capture this, and we're doing a lot in that, both PGE and Pacific Core are in the process of submitting plans. I know PGE has. I can't recall if Pacific has submitted their plan to do that. We're obviously, our job is to look at that and make sure that it's not redundant, it's an addition, and it's cost-effective. Emphasize the word cost-effective. We're not going to do things that aren't cost-effective, but we're going to take every opportunity to save customers money that we can on this side. So that gives that some of that. The implementing issues that we've been working on, the biggest one that I'm very happy to report on is an issue that I know you heard a lot about in the discussion of 838, and that is the cost recovery of renewable expenditures. Went back and forth on that. I'm very pleased to say that we have all of the parties that talk to you have been involved in our workshops, and they've come to consensus on how to deal with that. And we will be, by the end of the year, adopting administrative rules dealing with that. So I think that's pretty amazing considering the contentiousness that you had to deal with it, that they were able to come to consensus on that. And I applaud their willingness to work together and get that. I guess the bottom line on that, it's easy to write the rule. It's another thing to implement the rule once the projects start coming in for cost recovery. And we'll see how that goes. That's not a stranger activity to us. We deal with prudence review all the time, and we'll do that. So we've been doing a number of other rulemakings on that, and I just wanted to go through some of those activities just to cover what we're doing here. Some of the things, and I'm not going to read them all off here, it's just the implementation. Big pieces on the implementation of the renewable portfolios is you set a requirement that industries come up with a plan, how they're going to get there. That's it's updated every 2 years and has to be monitored. We're working on that, and as I testified during your discussion on that, we're trying to make sure that that activity is not duplicative of the integrated resource planning that we do as a general. We're trying to move those things together. Good thing to do to make them do it. The way we're going to make sure things happen, but we want to do it in the most administratively streamlined manner that we can. And again, we're having good relationships in doing with that. So, Madam Chair, that's very quick, over the top. It's early in the implementation of that, but I think the bottom line message that I would like to leave you with is that the utilities are doing good work on this. They're making progress. They're going to meet your goals easily in the early days. It may get a little tougher when we get beyond 2015 because of technical issues, but I'm optimistic that some of those technical issues will be resolved before we have to deal with them, and we'll make that good policy choice by the legislature. I think we're doing the right thing. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Lee. Any questions, Mr. Beyer? No.
Yes.
Okay. Great.
Yes.
Okay, I think
I was going to let everybody else go first.
I think Representative Burley has a question.
I've got a few, Madam Chair, if I may. In your handout, one of the bullets here under implementing 838-2007 activities, you talk about the commission having hearings on proposed rules dealing with the public purpose funds.
Mm-hmm.
Would you elaborate on that a little bit? Because one of the concerns that came to me was that the Energy Trust, when considering applications for grants, were requiring that the green tags be given to the trust.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had a lot of conversations about that, trying to figure out why and what happens to those tags, and shouldn't the project have the choice of what to do with those tanks. So I'm just curious, what's this rulemaking doing? Is it going to address the policy about the tags themselves? And
I'm going to let Schwartz answer that.
For the record, my name is Lisa Schwartz, the Oregon Public Utility Commission Vice Chair Burley. That rulemaking is addressing the public purpose charge, but it is not addressing the green tag issues. The thrust of that rulemaking addresses the fact that the funds for renewable resources should be dedicated to a specific project upon advice of our council, and administrative costs are handled through the grants agreement. But the thrust of that rulemaking does not cover policy issues related to green tags. However, you may be aware that the trust changed its green tag policy in March of this year to provide more flexibility on the green tag issue. Generally, the way it's working now is if, so long as the trust is receiving tags in proportion to it, their market value, they don't have to take title to all tags. And another important consideration is now with the renewable portfolio standard, it is not an above market cost for the utility to acquire these green tags because, in fact, they have to mm-hmm. to meet the law. And so the utilities can step in and purchase these tags from the facility, and that's going to be providing a lot more flexibility for projects in the future. And we think it especially helps such projects as biomass projects that really, really need that kind of support.
Follow up?
Yes. Another question. Chair Beyer, you had mentioned about the cost of energy going up in general, which is true, it is, but I maintain still that as long as we're mandating renewables, there's going to be a premium that will always be charged on renewables, and so coal and gas-fired power can go up all at once. Renewables will continue to be incrementally more expensive because of the mandate. So one of the things that I'm curious about and would be interested in seeing over time when we talk about implementing 838 is exactly what is the cost of these additional units of renewable energy that we're adding in Oregon. And I'd like to see those figures relative to the avoided costs or the market costs of the other types of conventional power. I think it's important that people understand exactly what this policy is costing the state of Oregon.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, we can do that, but I don't agree with your hypothesis that necessarily the renewables will necessarily be more. And I guess I'd say I'm not sure that that'll be the case. And the reason I raise that, and part of it is the big question that's out there is what nationally and perhaps by state are we going to do with regard to CO2 or carbon policy. Essentially what I'm seeing in the marketplace now is we sort of had a bunch of gas plants built in the early 90s, early 2000s, because gas is very cheap. You know, when I went on the commission, gas was $1.50 to $2 a unit. Well, during my early years on the commission, that went as high as $16, $17, and that pushes the cost of the output up considerably. When we did the last Port Westward internally, which is PGE's newest, very efficient plant, we said, well, you know, we hope we don't see another one of these gas plants because of the volatility we've seen in gas prices. We're moving away from that to something else. Nationally, a lot of the industry was moving towards coal, which has its own problems, but you've seen coal plants just plain shut down across because industry doesn't know what kind of cost it's going to be, what kind of cost premium will be placed on that for carbon. So all of a sudden we're seeing this just hit the brakes, slam back, and build gas plants, which is just going to cause a considerable issue around that. So prices are up. I mean, you know, sort of what I'm saying. I mean, it's kind of a long way around the horn to answer you saying, I'm not sure your hypothesis is correct, but certainly we can take a look and report as we get more down the line of implementing on this.
Okay, thank you. Two other very quick questions. I know the chair is
the biofuels folks
right
on deck. Yeah.
But just very briefly, if you wouldn't mind, some of us have gotten calls from constituents about this net metering issue and the change in the rules. Could you just very briefly kind of let us know what's going on relative to that? Yeah. And also very briefly let us know where are we with trying to resolve the residential exchange issue? BPA residential exchange.
The first one, I'll take the second one.
Vice Chair Burley, on net metering, the Commission adopted rules in July that were intended to increase the amount of net metering facilities around the state. To the extent a customer does not generate an entire year more from its system than they use any time during the year, they will be much better off under our new rules. There may be a very, very, very small segment, very small, where a system is sized significantly greater. The output is significantly greater than a customer uses in an entire year. For those customers, there's an option potentially to come to the commission and ask for a waiver. It's built into the rules, and in that case, they may be better off under the prior system, where they essentially get the same rate as a qualifying facility, the avoided cost rate, if there's any extra in a month. And that's a process that's available to any customer. They can call our hotline, and we've been advising them to do that. It's possible if that very small segment is not better off under our old rules.
Very quickly to the second issue, for those who are not familiar, the residential exchange is a program that allows, or it's a methodology that allows the customers of investor-owned utilities to receive a benefit or their share of the benefit of the Columbia Hydro system. Under that system, preference of the electricity goes to consumer-owned utilities, and the customers and privates get a rate credit, if you will, based on the difference in cost. That process was thrown into the unknown world in May when the Federal Court of Appeals decided that BPA's contracts that they signed in 2001 were, they hadn't followed their process. And so they said the contracts were illegal. As a result of that, BPA stopped the credit. And because the credit was gone, customers' rates of Pacific Core, PGE, and Idaho Power went up about 14%. They're still up. We have been arguing that the mechanism needs to be fixed and put in place, we being the state. The Public Utility Commission, the governor in August sent a letter to the BPA administrator saying that the system needs to be fixed, and he set two standards. He said any future rates should maintain the approximate average sharing that customers had been getting since the act was passed in 1981, and it should have some feature for adjusting for inflation over the next 20 years, or considering 20 years contracts, so that customers didn't lose. And in terms of proportionate, IOU customers across the four-state Northwest make up about a little better than 60% of all the customers. It's higher in Oregon, about three-quarters of all Oregonians buy their power there. Under the prior contract, they were getting about 16% of the benefit of the system. The utilities, collectively, public and private, have been trying to negotiate what they think is an agreement that they, in principle, they call it, they'll send forward. That agreement would reduce the prior payments by over $100 million a year and would have no inflation adjustment. From the commission's perspective, we think that's unfair to the Oregon ratepayers we represent, although we haven't been at the table, haven't been allowed to be at that table. And BPA has been very clear to say, even though they facilitated the discussions, they said all of that is outside supplemental and will be taken into consideration in the rate case, which they are likely to begin in January. They have been having workshops, but their formal process is like ours, is a rate case. That was going to, they were originally planning to start in December, but we were just told, I think it was yesterday or the day before, that they were going to push that back until the first of the year. That issue will be pushed back. Final resolution is probably in the fall. Now, the one glimmer of light in that is that there is discussion that BPA will reinstate part of the credits on what they call a true-up basis. In other words, we'll start a contract back and allow customers to get something on about 60% of the prior benefits with the understanding that at the end of the rate case, they'll be adjusted either upward or downward based on the outcome of that. So not a great situation. I'm not happy with it at all, but it's a BPA determination.
Thank you.
And just quickly, do we have any recourse on that? Can it be appealed? What's the process if that the decision in the rate case is not favorable for ratepayers in Oregon?
The final decision at the end of the day is challengeable in the courts, just like this one was that was thrown out by the consumer owned. So the PUC normally intervenes in the cases. We haven't made that decision, but it would be my assumption and intent that we would participate in that. Doesn't guarantee an outcome for us. We're just an intervener like any other utility or any other state.
Madam Chair, may I quickly comment on that? I'm not personally and intimately involved in this whole debate. I don't understand all the gory details of it, but it just seems to me that it's incumbent on all parties, including the state of Oregon, to resolve this issue. There are going to be losers, and there will be losers in this thing. But it seems to me the worst case scenario is that this thing ends up back in Congress, and the Northwest Power Act is being examined in Congress. And I think we all stand to lose a great deal more if that happens. So I really encourage all parties to work together, and everybody's going to have to take their hits with this thing, but let's get this resolved and move on.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Burley, again, I agree with your intent. I have to say that I'm not happy with the current settlement as we projected it from our side that we'll get clear to say we would get less under the proposed settlement at the start, and at the end of 20 years, collectively, all the ratepayer private utilities, instead of having 15 or 16% of the total benefit for better than 60% of the customers, we would essentially be getting about 1 to 2% of the benefits of the system. Or in essence, it would be fair to say that for most Oregonians, they would be getting no benefit out of the Columbia system. I think that's unfair.
Thank you, Mr. Breyer. Thank you very much. Appreciate your input. And I know we'll be hearing more from you probably at our next hearing. Okay, next I'm going to call up the Department of Agriculture. Lauren Henderson is going to give us a brief update on the biofuels, and then we'll take a quick recess while the Department, Water Resources Department sets up their presentation. Thank you, Lauren.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Lauren Henderson, Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I'll try to be very concise. You have a packet, or should have a packet, the Department of Energy and our agency put together. Just a resource for you is all it is.
Some light reading for the evening.
I'm sorry, it's so big. And that has, I think, all the information of where we're at today, including the enrolled bill and our temporary rules. I'm here to talk about the ethanol and the renewable fuel standard biodiesel part of this, and I will defer to the Department of Energy on the tax incentives. So far, I think it's going very well. This has been a good partnership between the Department of Ag and the Department of Energy, along with the major stakeholders in the industry involved in this. We've been meeting and have formed an advisory group. The advisory group's been working. The ethanol part of this was triggered by the Pacific Ethanol plant in Boardman on October 5th, and as such, we put together temporary rules. The House bill required a 90-day notice once the mandate was triggered. That's been done. The advisory committee has been meeting since September to talk about the permanent rules for this. And as such, there's been a couple of issues that have come out of those discussions that need more discussion. And we have subgroups formed. The two issues are this. One is a regional approach to the implementation. There were three regions that the advisory group decided need to go into place based on infrastructure primarily. And those were Region 1, which is part of the Willamette Valley, Region 2, and then Region 3 being the latest one, which would be July 15th of 08, to go into the ethanol requirement. So one of the issues right now is whether or not that can be compressed to two regions or not. So all of Eastern Oregon would go in place in April 15th. Those are ongoing discussions. I mean, at this point, you have a map in your packet towards the back that shows the three regions. The first region being January 15th, which would be when you go to get gas in the retail stations, you would see ethanol, would be Clackamas, Clatsop, Columbia, Marion, Multnomah, Polk, Tillamook, Washington, and Yamhill. I think most of the group is pretty well set on that. A region approach, it made the most sense for the infrastructure. We didn't want shortages and those things. The second issue, which I think none of us probably thought about, was whether or not this impacted aviation fuel.
Before you go there, though, a question is, do you not have dates for the other regions yet?
We do, I'm sorry.
Because you just mentioned Region 1.
April 15, 2008. Region 3 is July 15, 2008.
And just to clarify, there's agreement for everybody who's on this work group that I'm assuming is including the suppliers and obviously folks who are dealing with the infrastructure. There's agreement on those dates for actual implementation.
Chair Dingfelder, part of the next discussion, which is next week, is whether the regions, there has been some part of the group that would like to compress it to two regions and move three to two. And so that should be resolved, we hope, next week. There was agreement to do the regional approach instead of all one day.
Okay. Thank you.
The other issue being aviation, there has been some concern that the House bill included aviation, and there evidently is a small group of aircraft owners, primarily small aircraft, general aircraft, experimental, that do go down to the local gas station purchase gasoline to run their airplanes. And that was a surprise to all of us. So because of that, we have asked the Department of Aviation Director Clem to join us. And he is chairing a work group just for this issue to try to come up with some resolution to that. We have been asked to provide an exemption in our rules, and we've asked Department of Justice to look at the law and the rules, and Department of Justice feels pretty comfortable that the House bill or the law does not impose a requirement on those that use this fuel for the aviation to have to use it, which means they should still be able to buy regular gasoline for aviation use only. The issue becomes, and we will put that in a rule, a clarification that says it's okay to sell gasoline for aviation use only. The issue becomes an infrastructure one and partly a supply issue. If all the stations and the distributors are blending ethanol, will there still be a supply of gasoline without ethanol for those folks? We don't have the answer to that, and that is the whole purpose of the work group that Director Clem will be chairing to try to figure out some of those issues. So you may be getting calls on that. Director Clem is also working on a communication plan for the aviation community. To wrap this up, we are hoping to have permanent rules in place on the biodiesel part of this, which is going a little bit slower than the ethanol. In talking with the biodiesel folks, they don't anticipate a trigger being met until, I believe, the third quarter of 08, so that's going a little bit slower. But we hope to have the permanent rules in place for ethanol and biodiesel by the end of the first quarter of 2008. So I'll stop there.
Any questions? Representative Early.
I guess I'm a little troubled, and I'm not sure who could really answer this question. You know, we bought, my wife and I bought a 2004 used diesel pickup this year, and it's still under the original manufacturer's warranty, and the dealer told me under no circumstances should I put biodiesel in it without voiding the warranty. But then they also told me that subsequent to the federal standards for the ultra-low sulfur diesel, that apparently all 2006 or 2007 and later model diesel vehicles that are designed to burn this ultra-low sulfur cannot burn biodiesel. Is that true? Is there anybody heard anything about that? I mean, it seems, if it's true, it seems rather odd that all of a sudden we've got these competing and diametrically opposed policies in place.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Burley, if you don't mind, I would ask one of our technical folks to come up that I think.
They left.
No, they're here. I think Russ can very briefly, I think, get to this.
Russ, can you make sure?
Madam Chair, for the record, Russ Wyckoff, Administrator, Weights and Measures. I have not seen your warranty. The information that we had from the manufacturers during our work sessions and during the legislative process is that there were no manufacturers that had an issue at that time with anything up to B2. I think that's even being changed up to B5. And I'm not sure what your warranty says. Everything that we're hearing from all the major manufacturers, and we can actually pull up on the web some information from each manufacturer, but up to B5 is not information we have a problem for your vehicle. In addition, it's actually supposed to improve the lubricity and make it better for your vehicle. One of the things that was pointed out to us in our discussions with manufacturers is they really don't warrant fuel anyway. Your warranty doesn't include fuel.
Right.
So we can check on you. You can give us the manufacturer that you're involved with. We'll find out some more information. Our understanding is up to B5 is not an issue with any of the manufacturers.
Okay.
What about the newer model vehicles and the ultra-low sulfur? Is there any fact to that?
They are required to have ultra-low sulfur. I think it's S15 is what they're required, but that does not have any effect with the biodiesel. It would not cause you any issue.
So they can still burn the biodiesel?
Absolutely.
As well. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Any other questions, Representative Cannon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm confident that this regional approach makes sense given the infrastructure needs. I'm just curious, given the bill that my recollection states the mandate is triggered sort of automatically once the 40 million gallon capacity is reached, how you deal with this later implementation of the renewable fuel standard in certain parts of the state. That's not consistent with my memory of the bill. It may be good policy, but help me out with that.
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, we talked a lot about that, and how we dealt with that is all retailers on October 15th, which is when the rule went in place, were notified. That's what the bill required, that there be a notification. Everyone was notified in the state that the trigger had been met and that the state was now needing to comply with the 10%. So we notified people what region they were in, but we tried to address that through the notification. Everybody has been notified, and that what the regional approach, and that's how we dealt with that.
It's still not entirely clear to me. And again, I don't want to make a sort of mountain out of a molehill here, given that it sounds like you're taking a reasonable approach to implementing the renewable fuel standard. Nevertheless, the bill would appear to require not just the notification, but the actual triggering of the fuel standard within a certain, I can't remember the number of days, and I'm sort of scanning quickly to find it, but it seemed like the bill was rather prescriptive and perhaps overly prescriptive in terms of when the renewable fuel standard actually was to come into effect, subsequent to the triggering by the production capacity.
Yeah, Chair Dingfelder, Representative Cannon. Along with that, the first part of, I think it's Section 17, talks about the Department of Ag's responsibility to study production, use, and sales. And we took that information along with the notice, and that's how we came to the point where we knew that by studying the whole state's production, use, and sales, that the rest of the state, because the infrastructure could not come online at the same time, that the first region. And so that we looked at that, and based on that information, did comply with the notice by sending everyone within the 90 days that on January 15th the state is complying, and used that information that way.
I think the issue, Representative Cannon, was the availability to all parts of the state. And because the sources of the fuel come from different areas in the eastern part of the state, we had this discussion quite extensively during the hearings, that this was sort of a compromise that we can come up with without changing the actual date is, for the department to look at when because the supply sources are coming from different areas. The other thing is the metropolitan area, because of the city of Portland's renewable fuel standard, there, which I think is it's more robust than ours. They will be meeting that because they have to meet many of the suppliers they're supplying for the city of Portland. I don't know if you have any comments on that. But
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, in response to adding to what Lauren has said, in the monitoring the use and sales and working with all of the people involved, the terminals involved, had we implemented it straight across the board on January 15th, they would not have been able to supply the product. And I don't believe it was the intent of the bill to implement it and then not have gas available for the consumer. And in our monitoring the use and sales, it was determined that these nine counties in Region 1 had the capacity on that date. And so we followed our 90-day notification. As soon as the capacity levels had been reached, we implemented the mandate, and those could supply at that point 100% ethanol blended. And in working with our work groups, the other two trigger dates were put in there to implement the bill as required, at the same time having the infrastructure there so the consumer could actually get fuel.
I appreciate the department's working within, I think, the spirit and the intent of the bill to find a process that works for the entire state. So thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. We'll look forward to hearing updates, especially if you decide you're going to change some regions. Did you want to make a quick comment?
Yes, Madam Chair, Mark Kendall, Oregon Department of Energy. And there are three attributes to House Bill 2210 that the Oregon Department of Energy is involved in. And the first is the delivery and education in the marketplace about the biomass producer and collector tax credits. The second is implementation of administrative rules for the biofuel consumer tax credits, and then preparation for a study of the impacts of these bioenergy and biofuels incentives to the 2009 legislature. But I wanted to update you with regards to the biomass producer and collector's tax credits. They were quite specified in the statute, and there was no administrative rule making requested or called for. Our agency took initiative to develop a guide that helps summarize the producer and collector tax credits for people who are collecting woody biomass or seed oil crops or cellulosic materials for other uses in bioenergy production. And so we've produced that. It was reviewed by Revenue. It was reviewed by Agriculture and Forestry, and it's out and being distributed and available. And it identifies the mechanisms and the methodology by with which a farmer, rancher, forester can claim the credit. We have an administrative rulemaking underway with regards to the biofuel consumer credits, and if you'll recall, those provide for a 50 cent per gallon up to $200 credit for the use of B99 or 99% biodiesel, ethanol at 85% concentration, or biodiesel at 20% concentrations for space heating. And those are for individual resident tax holder or taxpayers. It also includes densified woody biomass for residential space heating. And we've held public hearings, the latest one on the 16th of November, and we'll expect to have the rules in place by December 1, day after tomorrow. The last comments were accepted on the 27th of November. We used the advisory group meeting process and included a number of people from the hearth products industry as well as biofuels industry. The last attribute that the Oregon Department of Energy is responsible for is legislative reporting, and it has a number of attributes that you're looking for that we measure. There were some reference to looking at what is the impact in you know, but for these incentives, what would the market have looked like, and what are we adding value to? And it includes jobs created, average wages, the number of acres of biofuels, the impacts and reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, and so forth. And we've developed a framework for that report. We're going to be using resources from both revenue, agriculture, from commodity commissions, as well as the utilities, to identify and attribute the characteristics of the incentives. You might know that a number of projects that participate in these production incentive programs also have capital investments that qualify for the business energy tax credit. And attributing that is going to be something that we'll want to coordinate with other programs so that we're not kind of double counting or double reporting the influence that these different incentives have had. But an example of some projects that have been underway just since the passage of the legislation, we know that 8,000 acres of canola and camelina have been planted this fall, and it'll be a seed oil crop. Summit Foods of North Plains is a blueberry processor, and they are building an ethanol plant, and they started right after their business plan started right after the passage of this legislation, because they'll be using their blueberry juice that is high sugar content, a waste product in their food processing, to produce ethanol. And they'll be also capable of using other food processors' wastes to produce ethanol in Oregon. And it's quite unique, and you won't find that kind of an alcohol producer anywhere in the region. So there's a number of other projects. We have two
companies, wood products companies that have hired their forest practices or forest management people to start collecting biomass from the forest instead of burn it in slash piles for energy supply. So we're seeing activity already. It's diversified. It's around the state. And we'll begin a study that I can assure you we're going to do all of the diligence to assure that we're not double attributing either utility incentives or capital tax credit incentives as a result of the impact of these production incentives. Great.
Thank you, Kendall. And as you move forward with putting that information together, can you make sure and send that to Beth so she can send it out to the committee? I think the guidance, actually, document that you mentioned would be useful. I'm sure it's probably on your website, but it doesn't hurt to send the link to Beth, and then she can follow up and send it out to everybody. So thank you very much.
Certainly can.
Gentlemen, I'm going to keep moving because we're going to be running late, so if you have lunch plans, we're probably going to be running over a few minutes, but thank you for those updates. Next, I'm going to call the Oregon Water Resources Department up for, and I hate to do this to you guys, but you're not going to have 15 minutes. You probably have to distill it down to about 7. And while you're setting up, if folks want to stand at ease, I think they need to set up their PowerPoint. I should have never let them go.
Hopefully they'll be back.
Well, I guess we will just get started. I'm sorry that I'm not going to be able to give you your full 15 minutes, but we are running behind. So I'll just say do the best you can, and we'll have you back certainly as the initiative keeps moving forward. But you might want to, for the committee's sake, and unfortunately we're missing a couple, just do a brief overview, since we have some new committee members, about the water supply and conservation update, because this wasn't something that we voted on in the committee, but it was through the budgeting process mainly that got approved. So if you can
Absolutely.
Provide a brief overview as well, that would be helpful.
Absolutely. And for the record, I'm Debbie Colbert. I'm with the Water Resources Department. I have with me Barry Norris, the state engineer of the Water Resources Department. And as the chair mentioned, we're here to give you an update on our implementation activities for the Oregon Water Supply and Conservation Initiative. This was a policy option package that was put forward by the governor last session, and the legislature chose to fund. And we wanted to use our few minutes with you today to give you a very quick update on each of the 5 elements of the initiative and where we are with implementing it.
Thank you.
Representative DeFilda, Barry Norris, Oregon Water Resources Department. You've seen this map before, critical groundwater areas, and the brown on this map illustrates where water is not available during the summer months for service water appropriation. This is a slide that we've added and you probably have not seen. It shows in red the mid-elevation snowpack, that snowpack that will be most subject to any increase in temperature as a result of climate change. It's over half of the state will be affected. The natural storage then for the state of Oregon, over the half of the state, will be affected as temperatures increase. This map shows the available water that's for the winter months. You can see in the colors of blue and green there is wintertime flow available during the winter months that has not been allocated by water right. Now, the initiative components, as Debbie said, there are 5. Assessment of existing and future water supply needs is 1. Inventory of conservation opportunities is 2. Inventory of potential storage sites, both above and below ground, is 4. A basin yield estimate of the state for the total quantity produced by a watershed was a 4th component, although unfunded. And finally, match funding for community and regional water supply planning. The first part, the assessment of water needs, we issued a notice or proposal, a request for proposals on 1st of October, and we selected a contractor on the 1st of November this month. We went through the process, and so we have now selected a contractor. We hope to be signing the contract and issuing a notice to proceed within the next a week or so. It's a statewide assessment of future supply needs. It'll include the assessment of economic trends, population trends, and all the things that would go into that. It'll put into 4 categories: municipal, industrial, and domestic, agriculture, irrigation, livestock, and so forth, as you can see on this slide and you have in your handouts. Eventually, it'll be a database. It'll have GIS-based scenario forecasts that you can go into, we can go into, anybody can go into, put in various parameters such as population or economic trends, and project a forecast for a water basin.
Very quickly, what's the time frame? Is it a 20, 50-year projections? What's the time frame?
15, 30-year, Chair. Okay. I'm sure. Conservation opportunities, the same process, request for proposals, contractor was selected. It'll be statewide. It'll include a database of location, type, description, estimated cost, water savings, and so on. You see the same schematic that I skipped through a second ago. The reason for them being identical is that the same contractor, it turned out, was selected for both projects. We reviewed them independently, weighted them according to a selection criteria, and it turned out the same one. Now, the fallout benefit from that is obvious. We're going to get a consistent database that operates the same, will interact with our database, so we will have some fallout benefits from that. Both studies will be doing a review of existing work, an outreach to water interests around the state, and then a concentration on areas where there's high population growth, expected rapid economic development, and so on. So we'll concentrate on those areas. The timeline, a kickoff workshop will be held December 20th with stakeholders. We'll be hopefully completed the outreach and data collection by April 2nd and populate the database. We'll do a data analysis and demand forecasting modeling efforts, develop the scenario model by May 20, final report by June 4, and then, of course, completion by 1 July for both projects, the conservation project and the future need assessment. The inventory of potential storage sites is above ground and below ground. It includes surface water storage sites like this. It'll be an interactive database that you can go and click on a site and get all kinds of, like this, all kinds of attributes for the site. I'll skip through them. You have them on your handout if you want to look more closely, of course. Views, photographs, reports, everything will be connected to that site, a link to that site, so somebody can click on it and review the information that's available on the surface water site. Now the computer's catching up with me there. Below-ground storage, typical below-ground storage site where the water's treated and passed during the winter surplus and injected down a well. We'll be studying that statewide. Another interactive site where you can click on an area in the state and view the aquifer characteristics, view any reports that have been written on studies for potential below-ground storage. We have a number of sites where they're doing testing in the state right now, so you'll be able to see what's going on and how that's progressed and how successful or whatever that it's been. People will be able to look around the state and see what's being done. And we'll assess the areas in the state as to a high potential, medium potential, or low potential. This is our timeline for completion of that below ground storage. It's already underway, and we expect to be completed by December of 2008. And finally, the water availability basins. This is a map of the state, and we have watershed characteristics for all of these individual water availability basins. There are about 3,000 of them around the state. And we did that for water availability on a CFS or basis by month. The basin yield analysis would develop acre feet that's produced out of a basin of the same basins per month. That, again, was not funded. It's moving along very slowly. We've managed to collect a bunch of data, and we have it in the database, but we don't expect to be done with that for several years, doing that with in-house resources. So then I'll ask Debbie to complete the final part of that.
The last element of our initiative, and it's actually something that was added as our department went out and talked about the need for these types of base information that Barry described to you, one of the things that we heard across the state was a need in different regions of the states and communities to be thinking about their long-term water supply needs and convening discussions about how they wanted to meet those long-term needs. And so based on that feedback, we added a fifth element to our initiative and our policy option package. package, and that was $200,000 for regional and community-based planning efforts. And so we presented this approach for how we would move forward with awarding those funds to our commission yesterday, and I'm presenting to you the information that we shared with the commission. We need to adjust some of this based on what we heard yesterday from them, our Water Resources Commission. But generally, we're thinking that the funding would be focused in two areas, predominantly looking at regional efforts to prioritize and identify water supply solutions. And then a second, smaller category would be some amount of funding to respond to special program needs. As we move forward with allocating those funds, we anticipate that there's going to be certain needs that will come up, that we wanted to hold some of the funding to respond to those needs as we move forward. So those are the two broad categories that we had envisioned for those funds. In terms of how we would rank proposals that we receive for these funding, we're thinking that several criteria we're going to use to rank proposals, and those proposals that have diverse stakeholder involvement and citizen involvement would be ranked higher. Those proposals that try to address regional approaches rather than single system approaches, but more regional approaches to water supply issues. Those that try to look at multiple fronts of water supply issues, things that, such as water quality and land use issues that could be concurrently addressed through water supply options. And then lastly, proposals that include local government representation, so that it's those proposals that it's clear that, that local land use and other decision makers are being involved in the discussion and this prioritizing how areas want to meet these long-term needs. And then lastly, just wanted to mention that it's our goal to do the request for proposals, have it out by mid-January, give folks about 60 days to respond to our request. That way they can have these discussions about who all wants to be involved and how they want to move these things forward. So have applications due mid-March, and then our goal would be to award funding by April 15th.
Great. Questions for Debbie? I have a couple. I want to make sure that if there's other questions, people get to ask them first. Okay, on that last part, Debbie, so this is a competitive grant program available to local governments, counties, cities, community water suppliers.
Madam Chair,
who's eligible?
The way that we are looking at eligibility is pretty broad. In as long as they can meet the contracting obligations of the state of Oregon, I mean fiscal requirements for receiving funds from Oregon, that they could apply. And then they would, and then we would rank by these other criteria in terms of the diversity of those involved, the kind of regional approaches that they're proposing to use.
Okay. And how much is available overall, and what do you see as an average size of a grant that would be?
Madam Chair, that's a very good question. I'm sorry that I missed that point. We're envisioning that we're going to be looking for requests for proposals up to $20,000 each. And as we discussed this with our commission, we were really trying to strike a balance where it was sufficient individual awards where they could actually get some good things done, but that we could also get money out to multiple areas across the state. So that was kind of the balance that we and our commission were trying to strike in terms of it overall, it's not a huge amount of funding.
And then how much total do you have?
I mean, the total is $200,000. For that portion of the initiative. And we would be expecting that the groups that are applying would bring about a 25% match as part of their proposal.
Okay. Madam Chair, that does raise a question in my mind, if I may ask.
Representative Burley.
Thank you. $20,000, $200,000, there's a list that's very long and very expensive list. I mean, some of these projects, just the study portion of it, I've seen some of them are $1.5 million to fund that stuff. So how do we, $200,000 isn't even the tip of the iceberg.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, you make a very good point. For example, in your area, the Deschutes alone, if you look at some of the Bureau of Interior Water 2025 money that has gone towards some of their water planning, it is bigger than the total amount that we have available. And so you make a really good point. But as we've been talking to different areas of the state, there's a lot of folks that feel like they can move some significant things forward with just a first increment up to $20,000. But your point is very well taken. I think there will be pretty substantial interest in these funds and a large total amount of request that we would anticipate.
Thank you. One question for Barry regarding the study. That I'm assuming that results of the study will be available on the web, on your website. You're going to have access to the metadata and everything that is behind all those different layers that you showed.
Chair Dingfeller, absolutely. In fact, we envision this the database being accessible over our website so that people can go in and run their own scenarios and pull out their own data on everything.
And I will certainly, as you're moving forward with this, want to have you come probably again in January, February, and give us an update on how it's going.
We would be glad to do that.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Just a comment is that Representative Burley raised a good point. I mean, there is not nearly enough money for adequate studies or looking at, you know, assessment of water supplies. I know many municipalities do it, and they build that into their rates, but smaller communities probably have a hard time funding those studies. So at least this is a good start, but I hope it's something that this body will look at in 2009 as part of the budgeting process, because I do hear from local communities about their needs. They don't have the resources necessarily to fund even the studies to see what is available, especially when it comes to groundwater supplies. So, thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, with that committee, we're going to switch gears to climate change, and then we'll probably have about 15 minutes on that, and then the remainder of the time before we all run off to lunch, we'll talk about legislative concepts. And we have a couple of panels that we're going to hear from today, a variety of folks from businesses, citizens groups, utility-based. We had a discussion at our last hearing, informational hearing on climate change, and there were some other folks who wanted to come forward and present their ideas since we're going to be talking about legislative concepts for 2008. So I'd like to invite up the first three folks on our list, John Carroll, Lisa Adato, and Barbara Byrd. If you could all come up, and you'll have to share a mic. Welcome. Thanks for coming. And, Mr. Carroll, why don't we start with you, and if you could please state your name for the record. Appreciate that.
My name is John Carroll, Portland resident, and Madam Chair, appreciate the opportunity. I made a note on my notes. I can't compliment all of you enough for taking up this issue and having a conversation with the public about it. I just want to tell you that I am an Oregonian. I'm a Portland developer, but most important, I'm a parent. In my life, I've absolutely have gone from no awareness to, at this particular point in my life, I feel like I'm looking down the barrel of a gun. And from 18 cents a gallon to 42 cents a gallon to incremental acceptance of now $3.40 a gallon and degradation of the environment, as a citizen, I've started making some decisions about my participation. As a developer, it brings all sorts of connotations, slime bag, trying to destroy the environment at the risk and at the cost of everyone else. But I can tell you that my community involvement has been at the core of my commitment and involvement in the development business. I've been involved in the streetcar, the past chairperson of the Portland Streetcar. I've been involved for 18 years at the time Councilman Blumenauer asked me to give it a couple months. 18 years later, I'm still involved, and I look forward to my 20-year participation level. But the thing that has evolved during that period in my life, business life, is that I've made a very calculating decision about only developing, only creating product within an environment where there is public infrastructure that exists and that supports the development that we pursue. And we have pursued urban downtown housing. The evolution has gone from, gee, that's what they did in New York, Chicago, and the like, to us saying, well, maybe in the context of our Oregon's history of planning, responsible planning, that maybe the Portland story and the bigger picture, the Oregon story, has been important in the evolution of our decisions about what kind of product and where we put product in the economic model. Green building practices. I tell you, it was an awkward conversation going back a few years. What is LEEDs? I get 1 point for a walk-off mat, and I get 1 point for 200 units of density on a site. The evolution of that process, and this is in support of your collective effort here, is that LEEDs ND, now a new program that acknowledges the value of development and its relationship to infrastructure, transportation, schools, parks, whether it's a clean building or not a clean building, very important part of the calculation. So when we talk about greenhouse gases and we talk about the environment down the road, what we're seeing in at least my industry models are that the system is now acknowledging and accepting that those are the standards. I guess what I'm sharing with you and what I hope to underscore is the fact that please be strident as you look down the road and talk about goals and talk about objectives. The sobering part of this is my daughter, she was 4 years old when I first got involved in the streetcar and started focusing on this development. She's now 21 years old. And in that time, I've started thinking about what are we going to leave her? You see newspaper reports that talk about UN reports that say the next 20 to 30 years. Well, my daughter will only be 50 years old if the crisis is coming, as they suggest. I want to use the Oregon model, Senate Bill 10-100, requiring a land use plan for every incorporated community. I'd like to build on that because I have personally taken this story, streetcars, development, urban planning, density, and the like, to 35 communities around the country. This Monday, I'm headed off to Columbus, Ohio, to meet with 200 of the developers, their city council, their mayor, to talk about why you want to go ahead and develop where the infrastructure exists. I think this is very much in support of the effort that you're pursuing here. The reason I'm being so wordy about this is that I think it's really important that we give you a vocabulary as you're trying to advance this with your constituents. Because the idea is that, it's not going to happen in my backyard, or no, that's not the way we've done it, and boy, it's just all a bunch of public relations stuff. The reality is that you've got children, you've got grandchildren, you've got yourselves that you've got to consider in the next 10 or 15 years as you look down the road, and I'd encourage the state of Oregon to continue to take that leadership. Economic, we've talked about it, environment, I'll be quick here. Economically, there's an opportunity for us to establish a model that is used around the country. We have an intellectual capital that we're developing here. We have technology that I believe we can develop here very quickly. We have a consultant base that I think can take this information around the country. People are moving to the state of Oregon because it's quality of life. If we continue telling that story, keep having our elected officials step up and say, we're going to continue this story. I think that's a story that will be easily told to the general public, to the general population of the country. We'll see growth when other communities are failing because people know the quality of their life is going to improve when they get here. Who does this affect? I'm going to be emotional and kind of dramatic, but it affects you, and it affects your children, and it affects your grandchildren. And I want to be part of the process. Hopefully you'll look to us as a resource, but I'd like to be a part of the process where we can help you advance these goals and these standards that you're going to take to the public. And if you get any grief, I'll be there standing next to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carroll, for coming today. Lisa.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Lisa Adato representing the Oregon Business Association. We're one of Oregon's leading voices for business, focusing on ensuring Oregon's long-term competitiveness. And we promote public policies that benefit all business sectors. We don't represent one particular sector, and all regions of the state. Our members include farmers, lawyers, wind developers, food processors, apparel manufacturers, software developers, bankers, and many others throughout Oregon. We are unified by a forward-looking and balanced approach to public policy issues. And in our legislative agenda and in the 2007 session, OBA provided strong support for a variety of climate-related bills, including some of the ones that you heard about this morning. We supported the biofuels bill, energy tax credits, the renewable portfolio standard, and the legislation that enacted climate goals and a research center and a climate commission. We think those things are important. We stated in our 2007 legislative agenda, OBA recognizes global climate change as a threat to Oregon's quality of life and economic health. We laud this committee and the governor's office for their efforts to take on this critical issue, and I'd like to share some of my thoughts as we move forward. First of all, we certainly should act as expeditiously as possible to enact climate change legislation. It makes sense to act as a region, and we support the inquiries and design activities that are being undertaken, such as those that are part of the Western Climate Initiative. We think that these actions have some benefits for Oregon. For one thing, early identification as a state that's aggressive on climate will enhance our competitive niche that we've identified as a state that supports sustainability, and we're bringing new companies in with that. We'll create new jobs, green-collar jobs, as we invest in energy-free products and processes. An important issue is that regulatory certainty will help businesses. I was recently at a conference, and 200 businesses were in the audience, and somebody stood up and said, well, what do we do? Do we start working on carbon or not? It's very hard to ask that question when there's no regulatory, or answer that question without regulatory certainty, because people might be penalized for early action unless they have some kind of an idea about the regulations. We think that participating in a regional approach will help Oregon get its voice at the table and help set a framework that will take our unique characteristics into consideration. In the 2009 session, it's likely that we'll be looking at a proposal for a utility-focused cap-and-trade program. We'll be asked to make decisions about a variety of what I consider arcane questions, although they're very important, such as how we define offsets and how allowances are allocated. But prior to getting to that detail, we should ask several big picture questions that set the context for electricity sector climate legislation. And we should ask these questions not as a substitution for action, but as an adjunct to action, because this really is one of the more profound issues facing us and will have profound effects on our economy. First of all, we need to have a conversation about how a carbon-constrained energy program will look. Simply put, how will we meet our energy needs in the future? If we can't use coal, where are we going to get our energy? Where will we get the baseload energy that's there even when the sun isn't shining and the wind isn't blowing? What's the vision that we're working for? What kinds of structures and investments and planning do we need to meet this vision for the future? Secondly, we need to ask about how a cap-and-trade program will affect the Oregon economy. We should be thinking about how to mitigate the impact on at-risk employers. We believe that supporting existing industry in Oregon is critical for an economic, social, and environmental perspective. It simply doesn't make sense to let key industries go to places such as China or force them to go to places such as China. With other types of pollution in the past, some of us or some people, I don't think I'd be one of them, might have thought, well, it's a benefit to Oregon to close polluting companies. That'll move pollution out of Oregon and keep our state cleaner. But global warming emissions are different. If Oregon manufacturers close and we export our manufacturing to China, we're simply worsening the problem. China has fewer efficiencies and environmental controls than we do, and emissions are created as we transport manufactured goods from a distant location. Oregon manufacturers are also a very important part of the economy and a vital part of the social fabric of many of our communities.
Key segments of the Oregon economy are based on low-cost energy. We need to understand the effects of policies such as the cap-and-trade program on our industrial base. What will be the effect on electricity and energy rates? Will energy costs go up? How high? How will this affect key employers and key communities? What policies should we enact to assist these industries and that will be affected? And a cap-and-trade program is much more significant than the RPS and the things that we were looking last year that were really talking about load growth. A cap-and-trade program would be going deep into our existing sources of energy. We recommend that we spend 2008 answering these critical questions so that we can be prepared to create a cap-and-trade program that minimizes an adverse effect on Oregon industry. Specifically, we recommend that the Oregon Department of Energy sponsor a study so that we can determine how Oregon industry will be impacted. Because I'm not here to say there will be this terrible impact. I think we don't know. We simply don't know how a cap-and-trade program would impact our economy. Based on the information that we garner, we recommend that we be poised to think outside the box and be willing to think of financial support for key economic sectors that rely on our historic availability of lower cost power, because that's so important to Oregon. This support should be predicated on the business's willingness to invest in best practices to reduce energy use. We should explore alternative rate schedules or service for at-risk industries. Third, we should work with our partners in other states to advocate for a massive federal investment into technology related to reducing carbon and creating a new federal economy. Meeting our state's global warming targets will be conditioned upon technological breakthroughs. Without these new technologies, we simply may not be able to meet goals to cut back carbon. Our current investments into new technology and infrastructure are simply inadequate, and the needs are above the resources of the state of Oregon. OBA members are talking about a Manhattan or Apollo-style kind of project with hundreds of billions of dollars in investment and economy-wide involvement. In addition to considering an electricity-focused cap-and-trade program, it will be critical to create incentives and programs for other sectors of our economy that emit carbon. OBA is working with other groups on issues such as green buildings and a climate-friendly transportation proposal that would impact other significant sectors. We have our own bill, the Environmental Enhancement Tax Credit, which offers tax incentives to the general business community for projects that reduce their environmental footprint, and this bill has a carbon feature. Finally, Oregon Business Association believes that climate legislation is necessary and urgent. We see potential for economic growth and opportunity as we invest to meet this challenge. The issue is very complex, and we urge you and want to take the time to understand the implications of our actions so that our approach is the right one, and we believe that 2008 should be a time of focused study and discussion. And I appreciate the chance to share my thoughts with you and to work with you on this critical issue.
Thank you. Thank you, Lisa. Ms. Byrd?
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. My name is Barbara Byrd. I'm the Secretary-Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I want to thank you for inviting me to testify on this issue on behalf of our 90,000 members. Some of what I say is actually going to echo very nicely what Lisa testified from the business standpoint on behalf of labor. We also supported much of the legislation in 2007 around renewable energy, and we're pleased to do that, and we want to encourage you to pursue this further in 08. We think it's urgent for some of the reasons that John mentioned. We have kids and grandkids, too, that will be affected by this problem. We have stepped up our involvement in this area, and I just want to let you know that at our convention in October of this year, we took a historic step of passing two resolutions that encouraged the Oregon AFL-CIO, mandated the Oregon AFL-CIO to take action in the area of global warming, and this was a first for us. Our first step is going to be to create a committee, a blue ribbon committee that will research the implications of climate change on workers in this state. I think it's a great idea for the state of Oregon coming to help us with that research. The committee will investigate the impact of inaction, of a failure to take action on Oregon's economy and jobs, and we'll also be looking at best practices to assure that the transition away from a fossil fuel-based economy is a just transition, and I hope that's a term that you'll add to your vocabulary as well. A just transition is a transition whereby workers are protected from economic hardship or insecurity as a result of the measures implemented in our state to address the crisis. We want to work with the governor's office, with our allies in the Oregon Apollo Alliance, and with elected leaders to enact policies that are effective but also equitable. I'd like to take an opportunity to outline some of the principles that we've been thinking about as we look into this crisis. These are evolving, and I want to let you know that we're beginning to think about this, though. They're not written in stone yet from our perspective, but we think there's some good ideas out there. First of all, we think that we need an explicit acknowledgement of the potential economic impact, both positive and negative, of the measures that are undertaken to deal with global warming. There's a general agreement that that an economy that's based increasingly on renewable energy technologies will stimulate economic development and create jobs, and a clear statement that this is, in fact, a goal of greenhouse gas emissions regulation will facilitate public acceptance of such measures. What's not acknowledged and is less known, as Lisa pointed out, but nonetheless is a big worry for our members, is that a shift away from fossil fuels will cost jobs in some Oregon industries. A long-run net positive effect overall doesn't reassure workers whose jobs are in jeopardy in the short run. A few percentage points decrease in greenhouse gas emissions won't make up for a worker's sudden inability to support her family. So until the potential negative impacts of the proposed actions are honestly and clearly acknowledged, we can't begin to address them. On the job creation side, we also feel like we need to explicitly encourage domestic manufacturing and local hiring. We talked about this during the 07 legislative session. Nothing much was done about it. There are other states where such measures have been successfully enacted, and we'd encourage you to take a look at those. We also need accountability and the will to adjust existing legislation as necessary. We were successful in getting language into some of the 07 energy legislation that called for an assessment of the number of jobs created and lost due to policy changes. I refer to a study in my testimony that I won't read to you, but there is some evidence that jobs are being created. We also have anecdotal evidence, though, that in some cases employers receiving the business energy tax credit for their work have brought in workers from out of state to take the jobs that have been created, and that's a concern to us. It bears watching, and some of it suggests changes that may need to be made in the policies during 08 and 09. Fourth, creative and effective measures to deal with job loss in shrinking industries need to be developed. Some of the answer to this problem will lie in adequate funding for retraining of dislocated workers, but our current system won't meet the anticipated need, and retraining alone can never solve the problem anyway, especially for our aging workforce. So we're looking for more creative approaches. Retirement bridges, wage replacement, financial assistance during worker training and education programs, and the targeting of economic development assistance to particularly hard-hit communities are promising approaches and should be explored. Fifth, and this is always an issue, right? These kinds of approaches will require financial investment. We think such measures can be adequately funded if carbon credits that are auctioned are used to create public benefits and not windfall profits. The auctioning of carbon credits as part of cap-and-trade legislation will generate millions of dollars, and a significant portion of these funds should be dedicated to the public good, to measures such as I've just mentioned, as well as others. Just a couple of other ideas that we've seen that are exciting to us. Research and development, particularly directed toward the revitalization of Oregon's manufacturing base, is something that could be supported out of those funds. Modernizing the grid. I know that everyone has struggled with this problem. Oregon's transmission capacity is overloaded and in some cases outmoded. We need to look at new technologies and expanding access to transmission lines. And most important to us in labor, we need to think about pathways to green jobs. The need for skilled workers in renewable energy areas will grow rapidly over time. The Oregon AFL-CIO has partnered with 3E Strategies, Sylvia Hayes' company in Bend, to undertake a survey of existing training programs and gaps that need to be filled in the renewable energy industry. We're going to be reporting on our findings by the end of the year, but I can tell you in a preliminary way that while there are some high-quality training programs in place, there are also signs of an uncoordinated approach to the development of new programs and a disturbing, for us, focus on short-term training with little attention to earning potential and career pathways for workers. This needs a lot more thought, I think, the screen jobs issue. Funds will be needed to assist existing training programs to attract the best and brightest of our high school graduates into green jobs, and we'll be working with in another part of the state legislature on workforce issues around this. But, for example, union apprenticeship programs have long prepared their enrollees for jobs in solar, wind, and related industries. We need more systematic approaches to building a pipeline from public schools into these high-quality training programs. We need to encourage partnerships between training programs and low-income communities where good job opportunities are scarce so that green pathways out of poverty become are more accessible. And finally, I want to mention one specific action I hope you'll take, and I was pleased to see it on your agenda, and that is to reintroduce the bill that Representative Brad Witt tried to get passed in 07, House Bill 2876, which would require retrofitting of state buildings to meet energy efficiency standards. We thought that was a great bill, creates jobs, saves energy, reduces greenhouse gas emissions, and we urge you to look at that for the 08 session. I'm going to end my testimony now by quoting to you from a document that the International Trade Union Congress will be submitting to the UN talks on climate change next week in Bali, and I'm going to be going as a delegate from the National AFL-CIO. This is, in fact, a global issue, and labor internationally is looking at it. So if you'll indulge me, I just want to read this quickly. We are now at an important crossroads, still possessing the means for making decisions about the type of future that will be passed on to generations that follow. We issue a message of solidarity because unions and workers are well aware that transitions will not come about easily, that moving toward a low-carbon economy and creating environmental responsibility will be difficult, fraught with the danger that the poorest end up assuming the greatest burden and costs. We aim to defend and support the most vulnerable in the course of what we hope to be a just transition process. Justice, rights, social protection, and training are the hallmark of such a process for a sustainable future. Thanks very much for allowing me to speak today, and we too look forward to engaging with you in this issue.
Thank you. And I'm really sorry to hear you have to go to Bali for that conference.
It's going to be tough. But,
you know. So, okay, any questions, Representative Gerard?
Madam Chair, Barbara, on my agenda, it says you represent the Oregon Apollo Alliance. Could you explain?
I'd be glad to. So I'm the Secretary-Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO, which is a founding member of the Oregon Apollo Alliance, and I'm actually, at this time, since the Oregon Apollo Alliance has no budget, staffing that organization. It is a coalition of labor, business, environmental groups and social justice groups here in Oregon, and it's a chapter of the National Apollo Alliance, which is a similar coalition at the national level, which is engaged at the national level in these same discussions around climate change, green jobs, and so on.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate your input. Hey, and next we're going to hear from three other folks, Jeremiah Bauman, Environment Oregon, Andrea Durbin, Oregon Environmental Council, and Jeff Bissonnette with Citizens Utility Board. And we're going to ask you to be, I'm always asking you to be brief. Jeremiah, it seems like I'm going to have to ask everyone to be brief because we're running over and we still have a work session.
I'm usually talking for a long time. So probably usually called for.
He's hoping we'll call after we met Danish together.
Andrew, why don't you go first? Thank you.
Chair Dingfelter, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andrea Durbin. I'm the Executive Director with Oregon Environmental Council, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to be here today. I'm here with a simple request. It is my hope that this committee will dedicate its expertise, time, and energy to address the urgent issue of climate change in the 2008 session. It is no secret to any of you that when it comes to climate change, time is of the essence.
As our elected leaders, you have the ability to change the course and act today to reduce global warming pollution and help protect our legacy. We can no longer talk about the problem or wait for Washington, D.C. to act to protect our state and our communities from the impending impacts of climate change. I could ask you to do this for the same reason the Nobel Prize-winning Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has implored leaders to act. Delaying action only increases our risk of severe long-term impacts by several orders of magnitude. I could say you should do this based on the many impacts we will see in Oregon, threats to our natural resource industries, changes in our snowpack, the impact on water supplies and water available for power, changes in weather, increased flooding and drought. But the fundamental reason why this committee should act is that our current situation is unsustainable. Change is inevitable, and we are in a stronger position now if we act today to reduce these impacts. By acting now, we are also better positioned to shape future federal policies that will be in our best interest. States are playing a leadership role today at climate change. The fact is, over 20 states are already on the move to develop their own policies because they see the economic imperative of getting ahead of the curve. Many governors, including our own, have been spurred to action because they understand that laying the foundation and moving to adopt a new low-carbon economy will be far less costly now than it will be in the future. The states are serving as innovators, competing to influence regional and national policy for their own economic benefit, and they are responding to rapid change in the public's desire to see their leaders do something to protect them and the future generations from future harm. It is notable that Washington State is considering a bill that would mandate the greenhouse gas reduction goals they established last year, directing state agencies to develop plans to meet the goals while providing tools to promote job creation within a low-carbon, clean energy economy. This committee should be proud for the fact that you were the first to act to establish greenhouse gas reduction goals in Oregon law through House Bill 3543. Members of the committee, both Democrat and Republican, supported that bill, and it was a very strong step forward, and we thank you. But the full measure of this law is meaningless until the state has the authority to meet the goals it outlines. There are several paths forward that are neither new nor revolutionary. Taken separately or together, they represent practical ways that Oregon can take immediate steps to generally address global warming. These include, first, making the 2007 greenhouse gas reduction goals binding. Second, directing state agencies to develop plans to enable Oregon to meet the state's limits. Third, giving the new Global Warming Advisory Commission the authority to coordinate state activity toward achieving greenhouse gas limits. Fourth, directing the Department of Environmental Quality to monitor and regulate greenhouse gases. And fifth, providing authority for the state to implement a cap-and-trade policy, giving preference to a regional system. Time is of the essence. It is our hope that you will use the 2008 session to begin this discussion in earnest and begin the process of reducing global warming pollution. Hopefully, you will move forward a position in position Oregon ahead of the curve, giving our economy and environment a leg up amidst the inevitable economic and political change that is on the horizon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Jeff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We represent residential ratepayers of regulated utilities, or statewide organization working on electricity, natural gas, and telecommunications issues. I will be quite brief today because you've heard, encapsulated in the testimony that's come before, and I'm sure Jeremiah will encapsulate it to end this hearing. But you have a variety of options open to you to act in 08, from essentially kind of leaving things where they stand and letting some things develop to being very aggressive. And I guess the thrust of my comments is sort of move forward somehow, that standing still and kind of waiting, or kind of standing where we ended in 2007 is probably not enough. There's a number of things going on that have been sort of alluded to in the previous testimony. There are discussions happening at the federal level around carbon capture cap and trade around other carbon reduction strategies. You know, the fact of the matter is that at the federal level, we're probably not going to see any significant action for a couple of years. There is a significant regional process called the Western Climate Initiative that the governors of six Western states, keep forgetting about Utah, came together and said, as a region, we can sort of move forward in a coordinated fashion, because everybody agrees that if you can't get a federal regime going, that working on a regional level is preferred rather than kind of having states go piecemeal by piecemeal. There's a lot of hope and a lot of energy going into the Western Climate Initiative, or WCI, process, and Oregon has very active representation in that process, and there's a lot of side conversations happening with other stakeholders and interest groups to hopefully influence that. The legislature could take action, and either by making the goals that you passed in 2007 binding, by giving some other sort of policy guidance to what Oregon would need to see come back from the WCI in 2009. 2009 is going to be no matter what you do in 2008, 2009 is going to be a huge climate change global warming session. And so it's up to, I think, this committee right now and to the membership of the 2008 session to decide how can we kind of lay a groundwork for 2009? How can we help move the discussion along in 2009? Again, you've kind of heard the variety of options that are open to you, and from the perspective of residential ratepayers who are going to be contending with the cost of a carbon-constrained world, I would encourage you to today take the action of, allowing, some kind of discussion happen with legislative council, and that we move forward with trying to put something together that we can work on and talk about in 08, and then we can talk about, again, sort of the depth that the committee will want to go. But the thrust of my comments is to move us forward somehow to influence the regional process, and if, heaven forbid, the regional process doesn't produce anything or falls apart somehow, that we as a state are that much further along and ready to have this conversation in depth in 2009. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thanks. Jeremiah.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeremiah Bauman. I'm representing Environment Oregon, a nonprofit environmental advocacy organization with about 29,000 members, including members in every county in the state. We are also the new organizational home of OSPIRG's environmental program. I'm just going to try to wrap up by talking a little bit about what I think, given our current situation, is policy-wise, what our sort of big-picture objectives should be in the short term as it relates to the 2008 session, and then talk about some specific policy ideas and how they would fit into those, including some of the ones that Andrea mentioned. Where we are at is that I think there's a pretty significant consensus that we need to act aggressively to reduce global warming pollution, the goal being to reduce it quickly enough and by a large enough margin to stabilize the change currently happening in the climate, in our atmosphere, and avoid the worst consequences of global warming. Where we're at with the policy, however, is that there are a lot of policy developments moving in a lot of different places, a lot of different forums rapidly. There are federal developments. There's this regional Western Climate Initiative, whose most immediate short-term objective is a multi-state cap-and-trade program to reduce pollution across six Western states. There are local governments that are acting, and then there are other states, as well as including our own, acting. So there's a lot happening. I think what that means in the short term for the Oregon legislature is that Oregon should send a message, first of all, that we're serious about meeting our carbon reduction goals. That does a couple of things aside from the symbolic value of communicating our seriousness. It gives the certainty that, as we heard from the Oregon Business Association, businesses require. There are literally businesses asking, should I be starting to address my carbon footprint now, or should I wait to see what's going to happen? And the answer should clearly be, start addressing it now. We need to make it clear that early actors will be rewarded, but we also need to make it clear that there are going to be carbon reduction programs in place in the short term, and so businesses should start acting now. It also, and I think this is an important factor, gives us a stronger voice, stronger influence in these regional and federal policy discussions and negotiations. One of the defining dynamics of the Western Climate Initiative right now is that California, by virtue of already having passed a mandate to develop and implement their economy-wide carbon reduction program, simply has a lot more influence at those tables because they are saying we're implementing something with or without the rest of the region. So they have a lot more drive in that process. I think if Oregon made it clear we're also going to be implementing something, it gives us a little more influence in those discussions and ability to address issues that are unique to Oregon, like our hydro system, like our status as an importer of energy and not an exporter. The second piece that I think is an overall objective is for the legislature to engage in the policy development. There's a lot of policy development happening in agencies, a lot of it happening in multi-state forums. I think we need to make it clear the legislature also is eager to weigh in as these policies come together. And third, provide some direction for how all these different forums and all these different policies ought to be coordinated to make sure that we are coming up with an overall system that's going to work best for the state of Oregon. So how did specific policy ideas fit into those objectives? I agree that a starting point is to make the goals that are already in statute binding upon the state. Obviously, we can't make the goals binding upon the actual private sector emitters of carbon right now because the specific direction in the form of the regulations what the cap and trade would look like is not in place. But I think we can say the state shall meet the following goals and start instructing agencies to develop those rules and programs, and in particular do it on a timeline that will set up the 2009 legislature to adequately evaluate those programs before they're implemented to make sure that the state is on track. So making the goals binding provides the certainty that the state will be acting, gives us a stronger voice in regional and federal discussions, and then the second piece that goes along with that is directing agencies to get started on the details. Third, I think and this is overlapping with the second point, I think there are two specific requests that the legislature should consider making. One is that to see a cap and trade design, preferably regional, before the 2009 legislature starts. And second, that transportation development plans, which is one of the biggest contributors to our carbon emissions, that as we start developing transportation plans for 2009, that those two discussions get merged and we see what that looks like, how the transportation investment happens in a way that meets our global warming pollution reduction goals. And then the final category of specific policies that the legislature should consider would be policies that make it clear the state doesn't want the problem to get worse during this next short-term period while we're developing the long-term plan for reducing our emissions. The most specific example you could think of was we wouldn't want to bring on a new power generation source that's going to significantly increase our carbon emissions at the same time the state's trying to figure out how to decrease our carbon emissions. Both California and Washington now have policies in place that simply say that utilities cannot bring on new sources of power generation that would have global warming pollution greater than the most efficient gas plants that are out there, along the lines of what PGE is just starting up at Port Westward. So that's my final recommendation to you. I will stop at that point and, of course, be happy to take any questions.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for the panel?
Yes.
I can't see over there, so I don't know. Okay. Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure if this panel would be the proper panel to address, I don't know if Mr. Carrier is going to come up and talk to us, but I do want to get into this Western Climate Initiative discussion a little bit more detail, so I'm not sure exactly who would be best to do that.
We had invited David Bantoff, and he's going to be here, so I don't know if any of you have been tracking I mean, that's part of the issue, is that the governor's office is involved in the Western Climate Initiative. Legislature isn't. So you could ask, and we could see if anybody here can answer it. So if not, we'll try to get that answer from the governor's office.
Well, I mean, we've heard several times from several of the witnesses about doing some regional work. And first of all, I also want to comment on OBA's testimony and the fact that they raised some very, very, very serious and significant questions, which I look forward to working with people and trying to come up with some good answers for those questions. But I want to know what the state of Oregon is doing right now. I want to know what's going on with this Western Climate Initiative. I want to know who's involved with it, who's representing the state of Oregon. I'm trying to find out who's on the subcommittees for these things, and that information is not being made available. It seems to me that if this region-wide policy forum, which your testimony says we need to get more involved with, is lacking in transparency, then there's a problem. So I'm trying to figure out what's going on here with WCI and who's involved. And so if there's anybody here that can answer those questions, I'd love to hear it.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, I'll be happy to explain my understanding of the process and people who are at the table for the Western Climate Initiative, but certainly I think it would probably be someone like Mr. Vantoff who's best positioned to give an official answer as an official participant. The Western Climate Initiative is an initiative being conducted jointly by six Western states as well as at least two Canadian provinces and one Mexican state to develop a multi-state program for reducing global warming pollution broadly, but their first objective is to develop a cap-and-trade system, at least for the electricity sector, but potentially for multiple industry sectors as well. The process is basically, because there's no official decision-making body that consists of those states, the governor's offices are developing the process, and my understanding of the process is that there are governor's offices are participating on the subcommittees that are addressing particular issues, and they're staffed by state agencies. Different states are chairing and participating in each of those subcommittees. I don't have any specific details on exactly who is on which committee either. And then in terms of the transparency, each state is conducting its own stakeholder process to get stakeholder input on the regional plan. So Oregon is planning, I believe, monthly or bi-monthly stakeholder meetings for all interested parties in the governor's office. I believe has also invited various sectors, if they are interested, to have separate meetings. Industry and environmentalists also want to communicate in various formats. I believe that's also been an option that has been put out to stakeholders. In addition to that, the regional process, so all of the states working together, have added a couple of multi-state processes to augment that stakeholder process. So they have monthly conference calls to brief stakeholders and take questions on where the process is at. And then they're now adding at least two and possibly three stakeholder meetings that are multi-state. The first one, my understanding is, will likely be in Portland in January, where anybody from any of the states is welcome to show up and provide testimony, give input, or engage in discussions with the policymakers from each of the states. That's the best understanding I have of the process right now.
Thank you, Jeremiah.
May I follow up on that, please?
Follow up.
Madam Chair, and Representative Burley, I share that same understanding. I think it's a good synopsis of the generally accepted understanding of the process. But in terms of legislative interest in kind of helping to influence that process, I think is precisely why we're coming to you to encourage this committee and the legislature in 2008 to have some of this discussion and see if there is some consensus around which the state can set policy that sort of directs Oregon representatives within that process to say, this is what the Oregon legislature is expecting, hoping to see come back from this process that will make it easier in 09 to accept whatever results come out of that regional process. So it makes 2008, February 2008 supplemental session, an extremely timely point on the timeline to have some of that discussion, and if we can get to a point again where we can reach a policy consensus so that we can actually, you know, have something that moves through the entire process, that would be extremely helpful.
Do you have another question, Representative Brewer?
Well, yeah, the way that I think this is playing itself out here is that because the work plan that the Western Climate Initiative has out, comments were due today on that thing, in fact, you know, their schedule is to have the product, whatever it is, completed by August 2008. And my concern is that August 2008, this product, whatever it is completed. January 2009, this legislature convenes, and bam, there's going to be an effort to enact this policy that this committee and this body has had no role in whatsoever in putting it together. That's my concern. That's why I'm trying to figure out how do we get engaged in that process.
And Madam Chair, Representative Burley, and that's exactly why we happen to have a February 08 session that, again, discussions in that during that session, legislation that might be able to come through that session could have, is precisely timed to have an impact on, you know, the August 08 product. And again, giving that, informing that process of what the state, you know, wants to or expects to see in 2009. I think it also, 2008 also serves as an opportunity to start to lay the groundwork for 2009, so we're not coming in cold in January of 09. And so, again, that was kind of the thrust of my comments, is to encourage this committee to authorize, you know, moving forward with some framework of formal discussion around climate change and potential policy approaches that this state wants to take, and that by the very nature of it happening will influence the regional process.
Just an observation, because I do serve on the Council of State Governments West, serve as chair of the Energy and Environment Committee there, and we had a discussion at the conference in September about this. There was presentations by some of the governors about this, and it came up as an issue that there is no parallel process with state legislatures, and, you know, it's really up to the individual legislatures to be interacting with the governor on these processes. And that was something that we talked about, is providing some type of coordinated interaction between state legislatures and through the WGA and the Climate Initiative. Part of the issue is, for us, we do not have professional policy staff to go to these meetings. The governor obviously has staff, the agencies attend. We do not have, except for our personal staff, we do not have policy staff. I'm sure Beth would probably like to go, but that work full-time on this issue. It's one of the frustrations I have with the way that the legislature here in Oregon is run, that we do not get the benefit of having professional policy staff that can work with the governor's office and with some of these professional, you know, NCSL, CSG, whatever, as they're crafting it. So I appreciate you bringing that forward. Appreciate you raising the concern about it. I think that's part of what we want to have a discussion about. We want to introduce legislation that can provide us with, a voice in that process. I think Representative Burley's right. And it comes out, and then, you know, we're reacting to it. We haven't had much of an opportunity to provide some input. So see if there's any other questions before we move into our work session. One last comment?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Burley, one other additional thought, I think, in addition to that I think this exact issue is one reason it would be good to have the legislature in 2008 say something to the Western Climate Initiative and make it clear that we're serious about engaging on these policy discussions. But the other, I think, point worth making is that the product of the Western Climate Initiative will not be an identical set of detailed rules that every single state will have to accept or reject coal. If you look at what's happened in the Northeast, where they already have a similar agreement in place, the states agreed to a pretty detailed set of principles and a model for it. Then each state has a fair amount of flexibility to implement certain provisions different ways. Some states have to implement through legislation. Some states can actually already do it administratively. So there are a lot of variables about how this actually will get implemented. So I don't, even if there were no engagement by the legislature, I don't think that in 2009 we would have no choice except to adopt or reject the regional agreement. I think there will be a lot more policy discussion for us to have. The key point of the regional agreement is it makes sure that if you're going to allow emitters to trade reductions so that a reduction in Utah can count against someone's goals in Oregon, those have to be identical so that it's a system with integrity and a carbon reduced in Utah is the same as carbon reduced in Oregon.
And Jeremiah, you're alluding to for a cap and trade system specifically? Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. And with that, I will close the informational meeting portion, and I will open up a work session to discuss possible drafting and measures through 2008 supplemental session. First, I'm going to ask Beth to talk about the two letters that you have in your packet.
Members, you should have all in front of you had a copy of two letters addressed to Representative Rosenbaum. The first deals with Senate Bill 704, which was passed in the last session, requiring dentists who use dental materials containing mercury to implement best management practices. Since the session, there has apparently been identified a glitch in that legislation. And the way it's written right now, it only covers dentists who are certified by a special district that manages wastewater. Apparently, this means that dentists who live in rural areas and work with associations as opposed to special districts on their wastewater are not covered by the bill. That wasn't the intent. So the drafting request is to clarify that part of Senate Bill 04, which deals with applicability.
And just to be clear, that all the parties are in agreement on this?
That's my understanding, yeah. And then the second letter you have in front of you deals with House Bill 2876, which was introduced in the 2007 session. It passed the House, went through the Senate committee, and was in Ways and Means when the session concluded. This bill requires state agencies that are authorized to finance construction, purchase, or renovation of structures used by the state to reduce the amount of energy they use by at least 20% by June 30th, 2015, from the amount used by the agency in 2000. So this request was that rules request the Legislative Council have this bill drafted for introduction to the 2008 session as well.
Okay. And this bill, I don't know, for those of you who are on the committee, you may recall it passed out of this committee, went to Ways and Means, and basically didn't move forward from then. But since then, there's been discussions with many of the members about it. There's broad bipartisan support. And I think it would be helpful, Beth, if you can talk a little bit about the process. Since this is the supplemental session is new to all of us, how that's going to work with these bills that have been submitted to the Rules Committee.
Okay. The difference this time from typical sessions is that there's a two-step approval process. So the first step is for a committee, in this case the Rules Committee, to approve a request for drafting. So that has not typically been done in the past, that the drafting request has to be approved by a committee. But that's the first step. And then the second step is that once the LC has drafted the concept, that the draft come back to the committees for approval for introduction. So there's another opportunity, and that would be in January, to actually look at language and decide as a committee whether or not that should be introduced.
So are there any questions about that process?
Would we have fiscal information available with the bill at that time?
No, typically there is not. However, there was a fiscal statement done on 2876 last session, and since we're just asking for the same bill to be introduced, I think you could pick that up and take a look at that, so we could give you that at the same time.
Could we make sure that with 2876, I think the fiscal is very important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Representative Reed?
Madam Chair, is it right that the Rules Committee met this morning already? Have they taken action on it?
They did.
Excellent.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. So with that, we will move on to the last item of discussion, which is getting measure drafted for the 2008 session from out of this committee. And Colleagues, we've heard some interesting discussion. We've had several panels here today, but also at the last hearing that we, or informational meeting that we had in Portland, we also had more general information. It's unfortunate that David Vantoff, who has been tracking the WCI process, couldn't be here today because there were some questions, obviously, we'll need to have answered. Certainly, we'll hope that he'll be able to attend in our next meeting. But I do think that there are some next steps. You know, we passed 3543 last session, which set goals, and it also set up the commission, which my understanding is has not met yet, hasn't been appointed. So we're sort of, in a way, acting. We have this time frame between now and 2009, and the question is, you know, are there some things that we can do in the interim to help us move towards meeting those goals? One of the things that has come up, and I've talked to many agencies about this, is, you know, what they're going to be doing in their own programs and plans to meet those goals. And there isn't, at this point, much direction, possibly from the governor's office. I don't know if Mike is just happened to be here, would want to comment on that, or if, as the legislative body that oversees also the budgets for these agencies and their programs, that we need to be looking at things during this interim time, that the agencies can come to us and say, here's some things that we think needs to happen and how that affects their current existing rules and regulations or existing programs or existing budgets, I think would be a value to hear from the agencies at a minimum. One of the other things that I've heard about is the goals. You know, to be honest, when we talked about it, I guess the assumption I had is that these were binding goals, and since that time we've had discussion about, well, are they binding or not? And I think that would be a worthwhile discussion to have during the 08 session. So what I have proposed also is looking at, you know, how we can be involved, as Representative Burley mentioned, more in the discussions with the governor's office about the Western Climate Initiative, because, again, there may be things that the agencies can implement, but there's probably going to be measures that will be coming to the legislature for discussion and possible adoption in 09. And I think we need to have that discussion ahead of time. We've got, you know, just over a year to do that, and I think that would be time well spent. So with that, I would like to have a discussion for drafting a measure. Obviously, at this point, it would be a concept, and we would come back in January with, I think, a more in-depth discussion. Hopefully, we could have David Vantoff here at that time so we could be engaged in more of a discussion. But at this point, today is the deadline if we do want to have anything drafted, and would like to hear from committee members. I don't know if we need to make a motion first.
I wasn't going to make a motion. I was going to make a comment, and that is that given, you know, given the nature of this, the process for this 2008 session, and the fact that we're being asked to sort of come up with one bill and get that request from the committee, I guess, my inclination would be not to take things off the table now, and at the risk of sort of overburdening legislative counsel, to draft a legislative concept that goes to them with that includes a whole range of potential actions this 2008 legislature might take, including the possibility of making these goals, global warming goals set forward in 3543 binding, getting the agencies sort of going on providing details in terms of how they're meeting those, potential impacts to industry as well as employees, as workers, our intention to see a cap-and-trade program in 2009. I mean, I think if it's possible now to draft a legislative concept that's broad enough to get legislative counsel to provide us with some ideas about how that might look, then we come back in January and say, well, which of this do we really want to introduce? Mm-hmm.
So, and I just want to be clear about the process. Beth, maybe you can repeat that, how the process would work, again, since this is a new and different process from what we're all used to during the regular sessions.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing you could do, if you're following up on Representative Cannon's idea, is to put the measure of drafting request into council with a number of items listed there, and give them direction to address each of these items in the concept. You'll then get a legislative concept draft back in January, and you could go through it and decide which of those things you would like to have in the concept that goes to the 08 session.
Okay. Does anyone have any questions about that process?
There's not enough time in the day to get into that.
Right, okay.
I should add one thing to that, and that is that if you followed that process, it would require, I think, at least two meetings of the committee in January, because first you'd have to look at what Wellesley comes up with initially, make changes to it, and then it would be back again and later.
Okay. And just to be clear, that anything that any LC draft that comes out obviously is going to be submitted to this committee for review, and then at the next meeting we would decide if we would move forward or not. So, in essence, we would be submitting a concept today. We would get back an LC draft. We'd meet again in January, possibly at the beginning of January, and then towards the end of January, depending on what's in the draft and what we want to see move forward. Any other discussion items or questions?
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Burrow,
I'd be having my comfort level would be much better today if I had something in writing that I could be looking at, that I had some idea what we are talking about when we talk about concepts. I'm a little nervous about agreeing to asking for a bill draft when we haven't said what we want the bill to be, and I've heard a full range of things here so far, so I guess I'm just going to continue listening here to this conversation and see what's actually offered. I would have liked to have seen something in writing before this committee meeting today so we could have had something to really look at.
Well, unfortunately, this is the first meeting, first of all, almost all. We haven't had all the committee members at any of the meetings. This is the first time, as you know, last time we had a meeting in Portland where we actually hadn't heard a lot of input until this time. And I apologize. I mean, time is running short, so we're sort of at this point where we have to make some decisions about whether we're going to move forward with the concept or not, what would be included in the concept. And in January, we would have something more tangible to look at, and at that point decide whether we're going to move forward with submittal or not. And I think it would be helpful to have vice chairs. We've talked about a few ideas, a few concepts. One, looking at having the agencies. I would find value in having the agencies review their existing plans and programs and come, with a recommendation to the legislature about here's the things that, we need to look at changing or adding to for addressing the climate change goals. I mean, we're asking the agencies to come back to us during the 2008 session and say, here are the things that need to happen in order to meet these climate change goals. We really don't know what internally, what changes we need to make as far as a state body in meeting those goals. I also do think that we heard today about some interesting ideas from business association impacts on our economy. Maybe, I'm not sure we're going to have the budget. I mean, that's the other thing. If we're going to have the budget to do an economic study, that'll have a fiscal on it, obviously. So that's one thing we have to consider. I think there's been discussion about the Western Climate Initiative and the role of the legislature in that. I'm not sure that absolutely needs legislation, but we could say that, we want the governor to be reporting to the committee on a regular basis about the involvement on the Western Climate Initiative. So those are some of the things that I heard today. I don't know if there's other concepts that people would like to propose, but that, I think, in a minimum.
My only comment is I'd like to object, but I don't know what to object to.
Well, I think that's sort of the point. This is just a concept at this point.
I can't even object to the concept, you see. So.
Well, Madam Chair, if I could, just for the purpose of having a little more conversation on this, I mean, everything that you've just mentioned are things that I agree with, but mm-hmm. I'm struggling trying to understand why we need a bill. I mean, we passed, and I did vote for 3543, and in there it says that, the policy of this state is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Now, if for some reason we don't think state agencies are doing their job to that, why didn't we have them here today and ask them today or last week or 2 weeks ago or a month ago? If we want to know what the governor's office is doing with WCI, then we have an oversight hearing and ask the governor's office to come down and tell us what they're doing. I don't see that we need legislation to do that. So that's kind of what I'm struggling with here at the moment.
Well, one of the things that we've heard today is about that the goals that were passed in 3543 are not binding. And so the agencies are not necessarily – there's nothing that requires an agency to go move forward and incorporate that. I think at a minimum, we could make those binding and ask agencies to develop plans and policies to meet those goals. You know, my concern is that if we wait until 2009, we all know that, with all due respect to the agency personnel in the audience, that bureaucracies move at a, I used to say glacial pace, but with global warming, I now say a snail's pace, because to incorporate any of those changes into their policies takes time. And at a minimum, I think as a legislature, we should be directing the agencies to start looking at the policies and plans to incorporate those goals into their operations. I don't know if there's any other thoughts on this side of the...
Thank you, Madam Chair. thoughts. I mean, I can understand the discomfort in not knowing what we're doing here, but whatever we're doing here is not binding. I mean, and thank God for that, because then I couldn't vote for it. But I think, I don't know about as broad as people want. I'm not really sure. Relating clauses, maybe there's an advantage, disadvantage there. But I don't think the number of meetings really makes any difference, because I think either way you're going to have the same amount of meetings, because you're going to have to look at the bill and then you're going to have to decide if you need to change it. So I don't know about what goes in it, but it's not binding, and I'll support going forward, and then we can decide what we're going to do.
Representative.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I mean, the fact is it's sort of a funny process. I mean, we can't get feedback from stakeholders until we have a concept. Until we have a bill in front of us. We can't have a bill in front of us until we have a concept. It's hard to develop a concept without getting the feedback from stakeholders. I mean, we're in a sort of a loop there that's a bit hard to see our way out of. I think what would be helpful is to provide a general concept to legislative council, see what they come back with in January, get the feedback that will, I would think, require at least one meeting to get feedback on, and then another meeting to decide perhaps what this committee plans to do in terms of action, introduction, non-introduction of pieces of that. And again, my hope would be that concept could at this point remain as broad as possible, an umbrella, if you will, that would allow us, and maybe it would be a subgroup of this committee to work with legislative council in December on fine-tuning some of the details of what that, you know, drafting is going to look like. So I share the need for more certainty, and the only way I can see moving forward and getting some certainty, getting some language in front of us, is to say to legislative council, we want you to do something that does, you know, makes the goals binding, gives agencies some directive, et cetera.
So I'm going to take a two-minute recess so I can talk to my vice chairs, so folks can stay in the room or not, and it'll be very short. So with that, we'll recess for about 2 minutes.
And require agencies to plan accordingly. It would include that we a way of making it clear that we want to be engaged in crafting those programs by asking the agencies to tell us before next session what the proposals are, and it would ask agencies to take a look at which of their ongoing programs and projects would need to be changed in order to meet the state's goals.
Okay, and I think we also, did we want to add anything per Representative Burley's questions about the WCI, about coordination or having reporting from the governor's office on the status of those meetings or that proposal?
Sure.
Okay. And encourage coordination between the governor's office and the legislative body on the Western Climate Initiative. Okay. And so there's a motion on the table. Is there any discussion on that motion? Representative Gord.
Madam Chair, just to kind of reiterate what we've been talking about, I'm happy to support the concept, and I'll vote yes for this. But I want, as Representative Beyer mentioned, there's no endorsement here. There's no support, because we just don't know what's there.
I think the way I look at it is this is similar to when a committee bill is submitted during our regular sessions. There's no commitment to vote for that bill. You're just approving that the process is moving forward with the concept. And what I propose, since we do not have anything for you to look at this time, that we form a work group with my two vice chairs, Excellent. Representative Burley and Representative Cannon, have graciously volunteered. Although the time is of the essence, so the proposal is that this work group would get together, work with Ledge Council in an expeditious manner, and hopefully we would have something by early January back in this committee. I know folks are not looking forward to two meetings in January, but in order for us to prepare for the February session, and we'll have a better sense in January, we'll have something we can review and react to. And at that time, we will have more testimony from the governor's office, and we can ask some of the agencies to come forward at that time and let us know what they think about the proposal as well. So that, any other comments or input? Okay, so hearing no further discussion, all in favor, please say aye as your name is called, and those opposed will say no. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative
Gerard? Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Excused.
Vice Chair Burley?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cannon?
Aye.
Chair Dingfelder?
Aye. So motion carries, and with that, I will conclude our work session and close the House Energy and Environment Committee, and we'll see you all in January. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.